Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call a meeting to order 9:07. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State. Is required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as Open Meetings Act. Mr. Chairman, I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Carter. Before we proceed with any business, I'd like to welcome the new commissioners, Commissioner Abel, Hildebrand, and Patton. You're going to thoroughly enjoy this duty. It's great for the state of Texas, and it's personal and rewarding. We have a great team and a great staff. I'd like to also congratulate the reappointment of Commissioner Galo. I'm so glad you're back. With that, I'll go on to the first order of business, the approval of the minutes of the previous work session held May 31st, 2019. The minutes have been distributed. Is there a motion for approval? Commissioner Latimer, seconded by Beaver. All in favor say aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Next, we have work session item one, update of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's progress in implementing the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. That's a lot,
Chairman.
Mr.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Carter Smith with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. I want to join you in welcoming our new commissioners. Obviously excited about working with you, and on behalf of all of our team, welcome. I think the chairman captured it well. You're going to find this appointment and experience very rich and rewarding, and all of us are really excited about working with you and supporting you in this capacity. Mr. Chairman, I've got a couple of things this morning that I want to just go through for you and the commissioners. Just as is customary, let me start with just a very quick report on the internal affairs team. Just as a reminder for you and all of the commission, as we approach the end of the fiscal year, one of the things that Major Gray will do is provide a year-end report to the commission that we'll probably get done, John, probably by the end of September is a reasonable time frame for us to shoot for, and that'll provide an annual summation of all of the complaints, both of a criminal and policy kind, that came before internal affairs. We'll stratify those by the nature of the complaint and division and also the dispensation of those, but it'll give you an important, again, summation of that activity inside the agency. Also just want to compliment John on continuing to work on the training and professional development for our investigators on that team. He and a number of them recently attended a training on death and homicide investigations there in New Braunfels. Obviously an unfortunate and unpleasant thing to be trained in, but unfortunately a necessary one for our investigators. And so, John, I appreciate you making sure that our team is up to speed with the most contemporary training and education. Just last but not least, Chairman, John has been working with Scott and his team on updating the operations manual for internal affairs, just to make sure that we have continually updated that with respect to our processes for handling and managing and disposing of all complaints that are coming forward inside the agency. So we'll make sure that you get an update on that once we're done. Just a couple of congratulations in order. I think last meeting, I'm looking for Craig. I'm always pointing you out. I don't know. You keep moving around on me over here. Need to check my left shoulder. We had a chance to celebrate Marcus De Jesus for an award that he had received, and I think we had mentioned that Marcus was about to get a promotion to our East Texas Regional Director. Marcus was our district biologist here in Central Texas and oversaw an eminently capable team of fisheries biologists and technicians helping to manage the Central Texas lakes and reservoirs and streams and all the fisheries and aquatic habitats in them. He's now been promoted to Regional Director, and so he's overseeing all of those functions in East Texas, and suffice to say, he and that team have got a lot to say grace over with some just world-class lakes and reservoirs, a lot of aquatic invasive-related issues, a lot of habitat-related enhancements, lots of community partnerships over there, and Marcus is very uniquely suited for that job. He's just got a great outgoing personality, and he's a real leader in the fisheries community and a very noted and respected biologist. So we're excited about that and look forward to working with him in this new capacity. And then over at Athens, at the Freshwater Fisheries Center, Mandy Scott retired, and Tom Lang was promoted to take that job. For our new commissioners, the Freshwater Fisheries Center in Athens, we've got a hatchery there. It's also a site for us to do outreach and education to the public about fisheries and fishing and conservation and aquatic habitat. We get, what, Craig, 70,000 or so folks that'll come to the center over there. The timing is also very serendipitous for Tom in that we're going through a modernization of that facility and updating that. We've got a partnership with the Parks and Wildlife Foundation to help manage through that construction project. Tom was up in Wichita Falls as our district biologist and one of our best outwardly facing community leaders inside the agency, really engaged with the community there on the revitalization of Lake Wichita, which was a hugely important project to that community up there, and they're going to miss him, but it's certainly the state's gain in this new capacity, so we want to welcome Tom to that position. While we're on the subject of all things inland fisheries, Craig, I think we'll make the whole presentation about your team today just to make your counterpart squirm over there on the front row. In May, we had the 13th annual Toyota Bassmaster Fest, and Commissioner Bell, I see you nodding your head. It's a wonderful event. You know, obviously, it's a professional fishing tournament, but it's a whole lot more. Toyota has really positioned that event to help promote conservation and the incredible fisheries work that our fisheries biologists are doing across the state. And so the narrative really is about conservation and stewardship and habitat conservation and developing quality fisheries. And inland fisheries is our point on that. Teams from all parts of the agencies help participate. Also want to certainly acknowledge Sabine River Authority, which was a great partner in this year's event and have been for a number of years. And so just want to thank Toyota for their long-time support since the lifespan of that event. They've donated upwards of $3 million to help with largely focused on getting more people in the outdoors fishing and have helped support our neighborhood fishing programs and so forth. And so we're really, really grateful for their leadership and support. And it's a great event, and I hope next May y'all can put that on your calendars. On another note, I want to just remind the commission about the sunset review that our counterpart agency, the Texas Historical Commission, just went through, and obviously which we are just starting to go through now, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. But as part of the Historical Commission's review, their reauthorizing legislation directed Parks and Wildlife to transfer 6 historic sites from our portfolio over to the Historical Commission. Those are some of our most sacred sites in the state, San Jacinto and Washington on the Brazos, but also, you know, important places like the Lighthouse down at Port Isabel and Monument Hill and Christy Brewery and Fanthorpe Inn and Lepantinlin. There is a lot of work underway to facilitate the transfer of those sites, all of the assets, contracts, land, projects, finances, records, artifacts, people, et cetera, by the end of this fiscal year. And I would be very remiss if I didn't acknowledge publicly a couple of folks that have worked assiduously on this, not the least of which has been Colette Barron-Brasby on our legal team, and Justin Rhodes and Kevin Good and Rodney Franklin on our state park team, who've done yeoman's work providing the leadership on this front. But also, just I'd ask you to just help me acknowledge our staff who manage those sites. As you can imagine, there's a fair amount of anxiety in the field going through a process like this when a site which you're responsible for managing or stewarding is going to be transferred to another agency, and you're staring down the gun barrel of looking at working for another entity. And I just want to compliment our staff in the field for their extraordinary professionalism and really doing a terrific job continuing to perform their duties, going above and beyond and managing through that anxiety and helping us transition to moving those sites over to the Historical Commission, which, by the way, has been a very good partner working with us to help facilitate the transfer. We have no doubt that those sites will continue down the road to their exemplary stewardship. But I'm grateful, Rodney, to the team for the work on this, and Bob for Colette's work on this, and others. So they've been terrific. Speaking of historic sites transfers, just a quick update on where we stand with the Battleship Texas. You will recall that Senate Bill 1511 mandated that we enter into a memorandum of understanding or agreement and a 99-year lease with a qualifying nonprofit organization to take over the operations and management of the Battleship Texas. Along with that, the Supplemental Appropriations Bill had a contingency rider that provided $35.5 million in appropriations to the department to really do two things, one of which, a half million of which, is to help fund our work in helping to remove, store, and secure the thousands of historical artifacts that exist on the Battleship Texas. And so our team has been very, very, very busy this summer doing that. The $35 million in remaining funds are contingency funds that will be granted out to the Battleship Texas Foundation, provided that they get approval from the Legislative Budget Board to go forward with their plan, which would involve moving the Battleship Texas Foundation from its current berth at San Jacinto and either through a wet or dry tow, taking it to a port either along the Gulf Coast or in some foreign country to replace the hull and then tow that back to Texas. That plan in engineering and design work is being conducted by a company called Valcor, which contains former executives of Dockwise, for any of you that have heard of that company, which is a marine transport company that is in the business of moving big offshore oil and gas rigs and large ships. And so they certainly know what they're doing, but they're the ones handling all the engineering, design, and permitting work. Ultimately, any plan to move that ship, I will remind you, has to get approved by the Legislative Budget Board. And so we held a meeting with the LBB staff about 2 weeks ago to facilitate a briefing on that project by Valcor and the Battleship Texas Foundation. And probably sometime in September, they'll be prepared to come back to the LBB with a more formal plan for them to review and then make a decision on. Our disbursement of that $35 million is obviously contingent upon the LBB's approval of that plan to go forward, and our MOU spells out the terms and deliverables and milestones by which we would grant that out. So as you might imagine, we've kind of got that managed in tranches from the funding, the engineering, the planning, the permitting, and then another tranche to deal with the tow out, another tranche to deal with the actual construction work, again, wherever that's going to be taken to, either domestically or internationally, and then the tow back, and then obviously a contingency and reserve. Bob and our legal team have worked very diligently with legislative offices and the LBB staff to make sure that our MOU provides all the requisite legal protections, not only for the department, but for the state. So we'll continue to keep you apprised on that, but at least as it now stands, we are looking at sometime in October to be transferring the operations and management of that ship to the Battleship Texas Foundation. So you might just kind of keep that in the back of your mind, but obviously we'll let you know when exactly that's going to happen and if it slides one way or the other. And if it slides, it would likely to be later as opposed to sooner. But we'll definitely keep you apprised on that front. Last thing, Chairman, that I want to cover is an overview of the sunset review process for the commission. Some of you have familiarity with this and others don't. So those of you that do, forgive the introduction here. But I do want to make sure that everybody has got an understanding of at least the process and timeline in which we're going to be going through. Just as a reminder, the sunset review process is required for all state agencies, all 140 state agencies, and it happens every 12 years. And the sunset legislation for any one individual agency essentially allows that agency to be reauthorized. The Sunset Commission, a standalone agency that's governed by 5 appointed state representatives, 5 senators, and 2 public members, and then staffed just like any agency might be. Their charge is to make a recommendation about whether the agency under review should be reauthorized, and if so, are there any changes from a management or a statutory perspective that should happen consistent with that reauthorization. So they have a very detailed process by which they review and do a deep dive into an agency's mission, governance, operations, programs, activities, and they're really looking for redundancies, they're looking for duplications, inefficiencies, they're looking for obstacles to effectively carrying out its legislatively directed mission. And they're looking for ways to help, you know, polish the proverbial gold. And so how can we make that agency better and more effective? The process, and I'll show you a timeline, is typically about a 6-month one for any agency going through it, not counting the legislative process on the back end. And both the initial sunset review process that ends up formulating specific recommendations for an agency, along with the legislative process that's required to pass a reauthorizing bill to go for the governor for his consideration, requires extensive public input and comment. So it is an opportunity for the public to engage on issues that are important to them. This is the contingent of House and Senate members who currently sit on the Sunset Commission. Just as a reminder, that the House members are appointed by the Speaker, the Senate members appointed by the Lieutenant Governor. You can see that they've got staggered terms, and a couple of the members on here in each chamber are slated to go off this year. So Senator Nichols and Watson, and then Representatives Thompson and Flynn, they could stay on. Again, this complement of members could change as well. But this is the current composition of the Sunset Review Board of the Commission. Typically, the chairing of the Commission rotates between chambers. And so in this past session, it was chaired by Senator Birdwell. And so then what that would likely portend for this time is that Chairman Patty would be overseeing the sunset process, and Senator Birdwell would serve as the vice chair. And typically what we've seen for larger agencies like ours is that the chair of the Sunset Commission typically sponsors that reauthorizing legislation and carries forward the recommendation from the Sunset Commission through the legislative process and the normal bill process that you're familiar with. A little bit on kind of the schedule of reviews or timelines. There are 20 agencies that are going through Sunset now. I'll show you a list of them. Basically, the Sunset Commission staff divides up their reviews into 2 tranches. There's a cohort that'll start in September, and then one will start sometime in April of 2020. But in the aggregate, those reviews, again, begin September. They'll start right after Labor Day. And then ultimately, the reviews of all of those agencies will be wrapped up by December of 2020. Sunset Commission will make their formal recommendations in January 2021 in time for the next legislative session. And then a bill proposed to reauthorize those agencies that includes the recommendations from the Sunset Commission will be sponsored then by one of the members of the Sunset Commission. So that's the general schedule. Here's the 20 agencies that are in our cohort. I'm obviously not going to read all of them, but I'll simply point out a couple of them that, you know, have relationships, collaborations, partnerships with the agency. You know, obviously entities like the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement Standards, or TCOL, they're the governing and standard-setting board for all law enforcement agencies in the state. And so any changes to TCOL will have a bearing on the department and our law enforcement functions. You can see that the Texas Animal Health Commission is also going through Sunset, an entity that we work very closely with on wildlife and livestock-related diseases. River authorities like San Jacinto River Authority and Brazos River Authority, who we work very closely with on the management of the state's waterways, are going through it. the prescribed burning board over at the Department of Agriculture that we work very closely with in our prescribed burning work, which, by the way, y'all will get an update from Jeff Sparks and Chris Schenck tomorrow on that work with our wildlife and state parks team, and I'm excited for y'all to learn more about that. This slide depicts kind of the life cycle for the two cohorts. Again, one starting in September, one starting in April. All 20 of us right now are in the throes of completing a staff-generated self-evaluation report. And so this is a introspective report that basically lays out for the Sunset Commission, you know, our agency or agencies like ours, spells out who we are, what we do, how we're organized, what the governance is, what the programs, the activities, you know, what some of the obstacles to getting our work done from a statutory perspective. Are there any obvious duplications or redundancies that we see across the state that we can identify to help them think through as they go through this review process? And so we've got a report that is due. It's actually due, I think, the 3rd of September, but internally we have all agreed that that report will be done before the opening day of dove season. So August 27th, I believe, is our internal deadline for this, and I'll respectfully remind all of us that are working on that. We have requested to be in that first cohort if we can in September. We think we ought to just jump right into it and get started on this, but obviously they'll let us know after Labor Day whether we'll start in either September or April. And obviously, y'all are going to be an important part of that. The Sunset Commission staff is going to want to interview all of the commissioners when they're doing their deep dive into the governance and programs and structures to get your perspectives on how the agency can improve. And I think that's exactly how we ought to look at this process. How can we be better? How can we improve? You know, are there some barriers, obstacles? Is there something missing? There's some redundancies or inefficiencies that we can take care of. And so that's certainly the spirit by which we're approaching it and supporting it from the staff level, and look forward to working with all of you in that regard. Ultimately, the reviews will be done after 5 or 6 months. At the end of that, there will be public meetings and public hearings that the Sunset Commission will hold, in which people can come and present their feedback and perspectives. Also, throughout this process, Sunset Commission staff will be talking with stakeholders of the department and getting their perspectives on the same kind of questions and topics that you and we will be asked to help answer and address as they formulate their recommendations. And then ultimately it culminates in January of 2021, in which the final recommendations that are made put into legislation, and then it goes through the legislative process. So just wanted to let you know that time cycle, and as soon as we know after Labor Day whether we'll be in that first or second cohort, obviously we'll let you know on that front. Just, you know, maybe just to help provide a little more granularity of this, last time we went through the Sunset review, they had a number of recommendations that came through. Some came from the commission, but same also came through the subsequent legislative process. So just as a reminder for the commission, the Sunset Commission may issue findings about here's some things that we think you ought to do differently from a management perspective, or here's some things statutorily that are going to have to be changed by the legislature. But once the authorizing bill goes forward in the legislature, it's also an opportunity for legislators to help make suggestions and changes to that reauthorizing language. So, again, multiple portals for input and influence on that legislation, and I just wanted to remind you of that. You know, again, some of the things that were identified the last time we went through, obviously we were reauthorized or we wouldn't be sitting and standing here today. Things like wanting us to have a list of aquatic plants that could be imported without a permit, requiring other state agencies that receive scientific comments from our biologist about fish and wildlife-related considerations of major development projects around the state, whether it's water or transmission or reservoirs or highways, that they were compelled to actually respond to those comments and provide some rationale for why they either adopted them or didn't. Also, the regular reporting to the commission that we do every time of on our internal affairs team was something that was required in the last sunset. And again, you can see here's a list of other things. I won't read them all to you, but they covered kind of a broad brush, and some of which bigger than others. But again, that sunset process becomes an opportunity for lots of things to potentially get hitched to the agency. And so something that obviously we look forward to working with the commission and all of you as we go forward. With that, Chairman, I think I'm gonna wrap it up and let the rest of the meeting ensue, unless you and any of the other commissioners have any questions for me about any of those topics. Okay, thanks, Chairman. Appreciate it.
With regard to work session item 2, financial overview, unless the commissioner has a questions today, I'll place the financial overview on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. With regard to work session item number 3, commercial non-game permits and miscellaneous wildlife division permits, the refusal of permit issuance or permit renewal, and the review of agency decision recommending the adoption of proposed changes. Unless there's a comment from any of the commissioners or questions, I'll place this item on the agenda, Thursday Commission meeting agenda, for public comment and action. Hearing none, we'll move to work session item number 4, amendment to the threatened and endangered species list rule. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. And I think, Meredith, you're going to make the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, and welcome new commissioners. My name, for the record, is Meredith Longoria. I'm the non-game and rare species program leader in the Wildlife Division. And it's important for me to note today that during this presentation, I'm representing a coordinated effort between coastal fisheries, inland fisheries, and wildlife divisions as I present proposed amendments to the state threatened and endangered species list rules. This morning, you'll hear me talk about two separate sets of lists. The state lists, which include state endangered species and state threatened species lists, and the federal lists, or species protected by the Endangered Species Act, that include federal endangered species and federal threatened species lists. They have some similar terminology that can get a little confusing, so please stop me if you have any questions or need further clarification at any point. I'll begin with a little background on regulations and statutes pertaining to our state threatened and endangered species lists. Section 68.002 of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Code dictates that species of fish and wildlife are listed as endangered on the state list if they are listed on the federal list of endangered species, or if, and here's where it gets a little confusing, they're considered threatened with statewide extinction as filed by the director of the department. Let me clarify that threatened with statewide extinction is a synonymous term with state endangered, and it's separate from what we call state or federally threatened species, hence the confusion. I'll elaborate more on what determines whether a species is to be considered threatened with statewide extinction on the next slide. As required by statute, our state endangered species list closely mirrors the federal endangered species list. However, the state threatened species list varies considerably from the federal threatened species list, as there's no similar statute that dictates what's to be listed as state threatened for animals. Section 68.003 of the Parks and Wildlife Code defines a species of fish and wildlife as threatened with statewide extinction if the department finds that the continued existence of that species is endangered due to destruction, drastic modification, or severe curtailment of habitat, its overutilization for commercial or sporting purposes, disease or predation, or other natural or man-made factors. In other words, state endangered means that a species is heading towards extinction in Texas. This statute provides TPWD with the flexibility to add species to the state list of endangered species that are not on the federal endangered species list, although that rarely occurs. State threatened species are defined under Section 65.175 of the Texas Administrative Code as any species that the department has determined is likely to become endangered in the future. In other words, if a species continues the same trajectory, it's likely to become state endangered. Again, there's no statute that dictates that fish and wildlife species that are on the federal threatened species list shall be added to the state threatened list. Species on the state threatened list receive priority for research and conservation funding. They also provide a nexus for encouraging developers and other state agencies to consult with us for guidance to minimize or avoid harm to these species and for building partnerships with landowners who can choose to implement voluntary conservation measures to benefit these species. As a result of these two things, keeping an up-to-date list of state-threatened species places us in a better position to avert the need for federal intervention and to keep these species under state's jurisdiction. According to Chapter 88 of Parks and Wildlife Code and Chapter 69 of Texas Administrative Code, plants are to be listed as endangered, threatened, or protected if listed as such on the U.S. list of plants species or as filed by the director of the department, similar to Fish and Wildlife. Code also states that if the list of endangered or threatened plants issued by the United States is modified, the director shall file an order with the Secretary of State accepting the modification if the plant occurs within the state. This means that any native plant in Texas that's on either the federal endangered or threatened species list must be reflected on the state lists accordingly. So that's a little different from animals.
Bobby Patton, I've actually got a question. Who's the director of the department?
The director of the department's Carter Smith.
Okay, good. All right, thank you, Carter. I'm gonna have one for you. So would coastal seagrass be covered by that?
As a native plant in Texas, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
But it's not recommended to be on the list.
No, it
but,
is
but
not.
But yes, yeah, it'd be a native plant, right.
Maybe it should be recommended to be on the list.
Yeah, that's certainly something that could be discussed.
So this list may also be amended by the director. In contrast, you might recall that Fish and Wildlife, only species on the federal endangered list must be reflected in the state endangered list based on statute. So that's a little different. Let me point out some of the major differences between the protections provided by state and federal lists, as shown here. Instead of reading it all to you, I want to really emphasize that the biggest difference that unlike federal law, state law does not protect habitat, only the organisms themselves. Habitat protection is one of the biggest sources of discontent with the federal protections afforded by the Endangered Species Act. And again, that does not apply to the state list of threatened and endangered species. The biggest value of the state list isn't in regulation, but in prioritizing and encouraging voluntary conservation efforts. To expand on that, the value provided by maintaining a current state threatened species list process is it allows us to identify and prioritize the most at-risk species in Texas based on current data that more accurately reflects their conservation needs. It directs our limited conservation resources to recover the most vulnerable and at-risk species, thereby giving us a greater opportunity to conserve and recover those species most at risk through consultation with industry and partnering with private landowners to provide guidance best available science. And ultimately, if we're successful in those endeavors, we can avert the need for federal protection entirely, keeping species under state jurisdiction. And finally, for those federally listed species on our state lists, the values I just described help us recover those species so that they no longer require federal protections, like the black-capped vireo, bringing them back under state jurisdiction. I'd like to highlight a few examples of progress made in terms of filling data gaps and precluding the federal listing or actual conservation successes in the state of Texas for some state-listed species. Due to genetic work we funded on freshwater mussels, it was determined that what we previously thought were four imperiled species were actually just two species, and they might actually be more common than previously thought. This gives us the opportunity to now focus our efforts on gaining a better understanding about their current status and threats. The reticulate collared lizard could have been listed, but it wasn't, as a result of research and data sharing between multiple state agencies. And those data revealed that it's more common than we previously thought. The Texas indigo snake is another example in which the state threatened status prioritized funding opportunities, allowing us to obtain more data that again shows that they're more common than we thought. And as I mentioned earlier, the black-capped vireo was recently removed from the federal endangered species list as a result of recovery due to the combination of research and then targeted educational efforts, as well as partnerships with landowners, governmental organizations, and stakeholder groups that led to the application of effective conservation measures on the ground. If Recovering America's Wildlife Act passes and Texas were to receive $57 million annually for research and conservation for non-game species, just imagine the progress we could make. Recent changes to our state threatened and endangered species lists have centered almost entirely on reflecting the changes made to the federal list of endangered species for fish and wildlife, or changes made to the federal list of threatened and endangered species for plants, as statutorily required. Enhanced methodology and data sharing have led to a more systematic approach that I'll elaborate on a little later in this presentation. We've been working diligently to fill data gaps for species of greatest conservation need, which I will refer to going forward as SGCN. And as a result, we've had an influx of new data that provides us with a better understanding of the conservation status and the needs of many SGCN. As we continue with this process, our state list will be updated regularly as new data is obtained to reflect current conservation needs. Staff in all three Natural Resource Divisions have been hard at work coordinating teams of species experts to conduct conservation status assessments using the NatureServe Network's protocol to evaluate SGCN identified in the Texas Conservation Action Plan, which is a time-intensive process given that we have over 1,300 SGCN associated with the action plan. This methodology is widely accepted because it's designed to be transparent, science-based, and to reduce bias from the species evaluation process. And this tool is either used by or is consistent with similar tools used by other state natural resource agencies, natural heritage programs, and conservation organizations across the nation. Essentially, this process lays the groundwork for consistently maintaining and regularly updating the state list of threatened and endangered species as new data is obtained to more accurately reflect changing conservation needs over time. The three main factors out of the 10 factors that are considered that this methodology uses to assign conservation status value to a species includes rarity, threats, and population trends, as you see here. After all factors are evaluated for a species, a resulting conservation status is generated. The conservation status of imperiled or critically imperiled is the threshold we used to recommend species to be added to the state threatened list, as those are the most at-risk species in Texas. The total recommended changes to the state list of threatened species across all three divisions, if approved, would result in adding 47 species and removing 13, with 102 species from the current list remaining. That would result in a total of 149 state threatened species, which represents approximately 11% of our SGCN. Why now? We've made significant gains in filling data gaps and applying this new methodology for evaluating at-risk species to better reflect their conservation needs. We plan to continue to do so and update our state list of threatened species on an ongoing, perhaps annual basis, to best direct our conservation efforts to protect our most at-risk species. As stated earlier, species being added and removed from the endangered state list shall simply reflect federal list changes. I'll now present the changes recommended by all three Natural Resource Divisions, starting with the recommended additions to the state list of threatened species. Most of our recommended additions to the state threatened list are species that occur here and nowhere else in the world, and are often highly isolated geographically and restricted to a very narrow set of environmental parameters. In other words, most of these species are unique to Texas, and we wish to keep them. First, we recommend adding four species of amphibians, three of which are on the federal threatened species list. 12 aquatic invertebrates, including these four freshwater mussel species, two of which are under review for federal listing. 7 aquatic snails, including these four. Most of these are associated with desert springs or cave springs. These three snails also, plus one isopod listed here, which is under review for listing. 3 species of birds listed here. 13 species of freshwater fish, including these four. And these four fish, including the Arkansas River speckled chub, which is under review for listing. 5 unique funding opportunities yielded considerable gains through research on these fish species, enabling inland fisheries staff to fill data gaps and better identify the conservation needs of these 13 freshwater fish species. After filling data gaps, the next step is conservation efforts. These two mammals, including the West Indian manatee, are also recommended for adding to the state threatened list, which was recently downlisted from endangered to threatened, and its current conservation status supports reflecting that change in the state list. 8 species of plants, including these 4 species, one of which is under review for listing. And these 4 species, 2 of which are under review for federal listing. These 2 reptiles, including the dune sagebrush lizard, which is under review for federal listing. We coordinate closely with the Comptroller's Office on research and conservation planning efforts for multiple at-risk species, and they agree that adding this species to the state's list of threatened species is complementary to their efforts in developing a voluntary conservation plan for dune sagebrush lizard in Texas. We also recommend adding 3 species of sharks, including the oceanic white-tipped shark, which was just listed as federally threatened. And in summary, we recommend adding a total of 47 imperiled or critically imperiled species to the state threatened list. We recommend removing the Texas hornshell from the state threatened list and adding it to the state endangered list according to statute, since it was just listed as federally endangered in 2018. As mentioned earlier in our in the progress stories that I mentioned, genetic research on these mussel species revealed that they're not separate species, and as such, they must be reevaluated under their new classification, and so we are recommending removing these from the state threatened list. These species should also be removed, as all 3 are no longer imperiled. And finally, we recommend removing 6 reptiles, including these 4 species, as new data indicates they're no longer imperiled in Texas and are more common than we thought, as well as these 2 species. In summary, that makes a total of 13 species we recommend removing from the state threatened list because they do not meet the conservation status threshold of imperiled or critically imperiled. Therefore, we can concentrate more closely on the most at-risk species. And finally, as stated earlier, the only changes to the state endangered list will reflect changes to the federal lists as statutorily required. As such, staff respectfully seek your permission to publish the proposed changes to the Texas Register, and I'm happy to take any questions you have at this time.
Is there any discussion by the commission? Yes, Commissioner Bell.
Just in terms of the items that we're looking at adding to the list, do you expect any pushback from different public groups saying that or have you gotten any feedback where people think that we're overstepping or overreacting?
I haven't received any feedback yet in that regard. However, I would anticipate there's usually any time you talk about adding something to a state list or a federal list for that matter, there'll probably be some folks that might disagree that feel like they might be impacted. But the thing to remember is that there aren't habitat protections, and adding these species to the state threatened list provides us with that opportunity to really focus our limited resources and efforts on working voluntarily with these groups that may resist that idea to recover these species or to learn more about them and find out that, in fact, they don't need to be on the state list and they certainly don't need to be on the federal list.
And the reason why I ask is because I think it's a very good effort, but it's always the communication, trying to keep everybody on the same page and keep everyone aligned and realize that we're all working for a similar purpose, which hopefully at the end of the day leaves us in a better position overall to look at these different species and make sure they're protected or that they continue to exist.
Absolutely. And I think that's where that message is critical, that this is our chance, our last chance to get ahead of any federal listing that might be much more problematic for groups that might be more severely impacted. Absolutely. Thank you.
How often do you do this? Update the list?
So this is the first comprehensive update since we've adopted this very systematic, transparent process of evaluating species conservation status. And so, we plan to do that regularly, whether it be annual or biannual is yet to be determined based on the resources that we have to put into gathering more data that allows us to reassess the conservation status of species.
If this is the first time, since when? How long has it been?
So 2015 was the last time that there were changes proposed to the state threatened and endangered species lists, and those mostly reflected federal listing action changes. And so there has never been a consistent, comprehensive approach at rehauling or making sure that we have an up-to-date list.
So 2015.
And
so I don't really have any specific about any one of these. I just wanted to understand if I did the math correct. This is a 30% increase in numbers of the list. So I just didn't know if that was a standard type of increase that big. But over 4 years, it's obviously not as big an increase.
Right. And if we're able to move forward with this as a systematic approach like we wish to do, then there should be fewer recommended additions each year. It would just be as needed and as we gain new information and are able to move forward with the removing or adding.
Yes. Commissioner Hillebrand.
Thanks for the overview. Can you speak to the delisting of the bald eagle? It's curious to me that is now off the list, and so just for my edification.
The bald eagle was federally delisted years ago. I can't remember exactly how many years ago. And that species is doing well in Texas. And it also still receives protection under some other federal laws. So it has a very high level of protection, and thus the need for it being on the state list just isn't there.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you, Meredith. If there's no other discussion, I authorize the staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period.
Thank you.
Work session item number 5, passive gear tagging rules. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Mr. Jarrett Barker, please make your presentation.
Good morning. Jared Barker. I'm the Assistant Commander over Fisheries Enforcement, and I'll be presenting to you passive gear changes. We'll be requesting permission to publish these changes. Be very brief, most likely. It's a less complicated issue. So these changes that we're proposing are coming from guidance that we received at the last commission about maybe accelerating our ability to remove passive gear from public water. And so we did a review of the statutes and commission rules around passive gear to look at what are some of the obstacles and what we can do to accelerate that process. Some of the negative impacts of these passive fishing gears are they continue to catch fish when they're left in the water. The gear is hard to identify. What you're looking at in the slide here is a jug line. You know, there could be multiple variations of that, but it's one of the only gears that actually has a float, and it's because in order to create the jug line, you have a float on it, so it's easily identified. But the passive gears that we're talking about are jug lines, trot lines, throw lines, minnow traps, and perch traps. Most of those gears do not have any floats on them, so they're placed in public water by an individual who wants to catch the resource. And if abandoned or forgotten, that gear will stay there, and it's not easily identified by our law enforcement patrols, because you just quite honestly don't notice a small string tied to a stick on the shoreline. So adding some new requirements around this gear is going to aid us in identifying that and locating it. Some of the problems, again, with this passive fishing gear is fish mortality increases as they remain hooked longer than 4 days. The devices can continue to fish when they're not baited. So even our law enforcement patrols have pulled and removed this gear, and it's very easily recognized that the gear's been there for quite a long time, but we will find fish that are still attached to the gear or hooked recently. Inland Fisheries has done some studies to kind of confirm that, and the gear continues to fish and catch even when it's not baited with a bait on the hook. And then the abandoned gear represents a nuisance to other anglers. I'm sure many of you have been bass fishing and you're casting and reeling in, and you'll hook a trot line that you didn't see that was there in the water. That gear also gets entangled in boat props and, you know, could be in a conflict with water skiers and other users of our public water. So the removal requirements, game wardens who inspect passive gear were authorized under Chapter 12 and actually directed under Chapter 12 to remove gear that is placed in violation of commission rules. And that process requires us to post public notification through a local judge directing the sheriff to post at the courthouse that this gear has been removed from a public water body. It takes a certain amount of time. This Chapter 12 rule is not something that offers a whole lot of flexibility, but we have identified that if we make some changes in the gear definitions themselves, in order to be a legal jug line, it's got to have a gear tag. There's some definition proposal changes within this that we would like to make. That will clearly define what is a legal fishing gear and what is not. There's other illegal fishing gears that people place out there, like a hoop net is something that is prohibited in Texas that we do come across in some of our patrols. So some of the proposed changes, we're going to recommend adding the customer number that is on an individual's fishing license to the gear tag itself. Currently, the name and address of the individual who placed the device in public water is the only requirement. Adding the customer number will allow law enforcement to access information about the individual who placed the device, but it doesn't reveal any more information to other members of the public about the individual who placed the device in public water. So there's some privacy protections in place there. We're adding the gear tag as part of the device definition, again, so that if the device does not have a gear tag, well, then it's no longer a jug line under the defined statute. We are reducing the number of days from 10 down to 4 days that a device could be placed in the water. They could renew the gear tag and continue fishing it. So an individual still has the ability to fish for 30 days straight, but it just communicates to us that they're updating their tag. They intended to leave that device there. And so we know that it's not catching fish, you know, as an abandoned situation. And it's going to require, or we're recommending requiring, all passive gear to be marked with a float above the waterline. That's going to allow us as a law enforcement patrol to identify that that device is there. It's going to prompt us to check it and look at it, look at the gear tag. Has it been placed? Is it actively being checked? And if not, well, then that's going to be part of that accelerated process of us removing the gear. Within that, there'll be some other recommendations about orange being reserved for commercial activity. Even our inland fisheries staff, if they wanted to survey the use of a public water body, recreational use versus commercial use, they could drive the lake and survey it just based upon the colors of the floats, orange being reserved for commercial, any other color being utilized by recreational fishermen. They would know, you know, is there commercial activity out here, how much commercial activity, how many days. It kind of affords them some more data that they can collect based upon public use. Again, this is what, say, a trot line would look like. At the terminal ends where you might attach it to shore or to an anchored, you would see an orange float tied out onto the water. And again, at the shoreline, that's going to tell you the direction of the line that's suspended underneath the water. So if you were another fisherman, you could avoid that if you wanted to. If there was a lake level drop and now the water surface was just a little bit above the hooks, a water skier or another public user would know maybe to avoid that stretch. Trot lines are not always tied to the shoreline and then out into the main lake. Sometimes they're placed in open water body. And the same for jug lines, throw lines, limb lines that are tied to a tree. They're going to have this same float setup. It'll be pretty standard. So again, these proposed changes will aid in the unintended catch of fish and other wildlife resources. They're going to help identify the location of the passive gear and help facilitate the removal of that gear from public water. And if you have any questions, I'd like to entertain those at this time. Yes, sir.
Bobby Patton, would a crab trap be included or potentially included in this?
Well, crab traps are included. They're not part of the proposed changes, as they already are required to have a float marked with the same gear requirements. And the modification to the gear tag will, because the crab trap is required to be marked with a gear tag, it's going to encompass those same changes. But since they already have the float, it's less impactful for that gear.
Do any of the proposed changes make the removal process easier as far as it relates to the public notification?
That's a great question. It doesn't. Chapter 12 is written pretty tightly, where the language in there uses the terminology of fishing gear. So I think any device, be it a hoop net, which is clearly illegal, or a trot line without the proper gear tag, is going to be fishing gear. So we're still going to need to do some of that public notification, but tightening up the definitions, we're trying to get to a point where, let's say if I go to the lake and take a 12-pack of Coca-Cola, that Coke can that's sitting on my boat is mine. Nobody could come take it from me without it being theft. But if I crush it and throw it away, I've abandoned it, much like some of this fishing gear. There's nothing to prevent public organizations, non-government organizations, or me as an officer to come pick up that trash and dispose of it. That's where we would like to get to. And we would like to open Chapter 12 in the next legislative session to kind of get some better clarification or designate more in there what we could get rid of. But that's what we're trying to get to, is so that anybody could remove that gear that is abandoned and derelict.
Yes, Commissioner.
Would the fact that if we pass these rules, would that then make the gear that didn't have this identification or these parameters illegal then?
I don't believe so. We've vetted some of that discussion with legal, and given that Chapter 12 just says fishing gear, I don't think it gets us there right now, but making the changes will make the changes that we would like to make to Chapter 12 at the next legislative session a little bit easier to write.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, it wouldn't be illegal, but you guys could remove it.
Absolutely. We could remove it. We'll still do the notification and the posting.
Any other questions? Authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period.
Thank you.
Work session item number 6, amendment to deer breeder regulations, additional testing options for breeders to regain movement qualified status. Recommended adoption of proposed changes. Mr. Mitch Lockwood, please make your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood. I'm the Big Game Program Director for the Wildlife Division. Tomorrow, I intend to seek adoption of proposed amendments to rules governing deer breeding activities. Specifically, the proposed amendments would provide, those deer breeders that have not been able to maintain movement qualified status under existing rules. Movement qualified status is obtained and maintained through adequate surveillance for chronic wasting disease, and it is a status that is necessary to be able to transfer deer into or out of a facility. For the benefit of our new commissioners and for a refresher for all, I think it would be a good idea if we spend just a little time reviewing some background information. Chronic wasting disease, or CWD, is a very serious neurological disease that affects white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, and at least some other species of cervids. This contagious disease, for which there is no known cure or treatment, always results in death, and it is known to have population impacts at relatively high prevalence rates. There was significant concern for widespread transmission of this disease throughout the state in 2015 when it was detected in a deer breeding facility that had transferred lots of deer to many different facilities throughout this state. During the blue dots that are on the slide before you represent the approximate locations of deer breeding facilities that had transferred deer to this index facility, or the facility where the disease was first detected in captivity. And the red dots represent 145 different facilities in the state that have received 835 deer from that index facility during the preceding five-year period. In an attempt to detect this disease early and to minimize the likelihood of transmitting this disease via permitted activities, such as the movement of live deer, this commission adopted a comprehensive CWD rule package on June the 20th, 2016. That rule package resulted in increased CWD surveillance requirements, But they do allow for antemortem or live animal testing to help achieve those requirements. For example, if a deer breeder is not able to collect a sample from a deer that dies in his facility in a timely manner, and therefore that sample deteriorates to the point where it's not testable, then that deer breeder may collect samples from live deer in the facility and use the test results from those deer as substitutes for those missing postmortem tests. Under this comprehensive CWD rule package, more than 91% of the deer breeders have been able to either maintain movement qualified status or at least be able to regain movement qualified status immediately by taking advantage of these live testing options. Nonetheless, for various reasons, a small number of deer breeders have fallen so far below the minimum testing requirements or simply have released so many deer from the facilities before losing that movement qualified status that they are unable to take advantage of these antemortem testing options to immediately regain movement qualified status. In order to help these individuals obtain movement qualified status within a 2-year period, in fact, in many cases in just over a year period, this commission adopted rule amendments just 5 months ago to provide additional antemortem testing options, which basically allow for 2 whole herd antemortem tests at 12-month intervals. However, some deer breeders in this situation are seeking more expeditious ways to achieve movement qualified status. And with that in mind, this commission directed staff to reconvene the CWD task force to explore additional options. After much discussion with stakeholders, staff proposed to allow deer breeders who are unable to immediately regain that movement qualified status to be able to transfer deer to release sites following a single whole herd antemortem test. All age-eligible animals in the facility would be tested using this live testing procedure at least 12 months following all animals or the herd inventory being documented. And then that breeding facility and any recipient release site would need to agree to operate under a testing plan that is written by the state wildlife veterinarian. And that testing plan would be designed to achieve a sufficient confidence that the disease would be detected at some predetermined prevalence. Now, during the March work session of this commission, when I first proposed a testing plan that would achieve 95% confidence that the disease would be detected at a 5% prevalence, there was some discussion amongst the commission whether that was adequate. Staff were ultimately authorized to publish a proposal that would require a testing plan that was sufficient to achieve 99% confidence that the disease would be detected at a 5% prevalence, realizing that this commission may opt to amend this particular requirement prior to adopting the proposal. With that in mind, and understanding that if present, the disease prevalence would likely be less than 5%, I was asked to provide some information to help explain just what it means to be able to obtain a specific level of confidence that the disease would be detected at various prevalence levels. This table shows prevalence on the y-axis there on the left and detection probability on the x-axis across the top. And the body of the table indicates the number of samples that must be tested to achieve these confidence levels. The required sample size, as you can see, increases as you move from left to right or as you try to obtain higher and higher detection probabilities, or another way to put it is you want to try to increase your confidence in detecting that disease. Likewise, more samples are required to detect the disease at lower prevalence rates. In other words, the less common the disease is, the harder you have to look for it. We and others know that a prevalence of 5%, especially out in the pasture, indicates that disease has likely been on the release site for quite some time, likely years. The prevalence at almost all CWD-positive release sites in this state range from less than 1% to almost 3%, even though the 2 source breeding facilities combined have detected CWD in more than 80 deer. The point with this is that the disease is expected to occur at lower prevalence and be more difficult to detect on release sites than it is in captive facilities. With that in mind, using a model that is designed to detect the disease, if it occurs on recipient release sites at a 5% prevalence, might not meet this commission's goal for early detection. The proposal as published would require a participant to submit 91 not detected test results to regain movement qualified status, as is illustrated here in the near the top right section of this table. This would give us 99% confidence that the disease would be detected if present in 5 out of every 100 deer. Now, if you wanted to have the same degree of confidence that the disease would be detected if only 2 out of 100 deer were infected, you would need 229 samples, but only 149 samples would be required if you were satisfied with obtaining 95% confidence that the disease would be detected at a 2% prevalence. So in closing, the proposal published in the Texas Register is designed to detect the disease with 99% confidence once the disease has reached a prevalence level of 5%. I'll take your direction on whether to proceed tomorrow with the proposal as written or modify the proposal based on your relative risk tolerance. I believe this commission has received a letter of concern from David Yates, the CEO of Texas Wildlife Association. Other than that letter, and until this morning, we have received 2 comments on this proposal, both in opposition to the proposal, none of which provided any rationale for that opposition. Now, this morning, as recent as just a few minutes ago, I've received 11 more comments by email. They were in the form of a form letter, I guess is the best way to put it. And those comments, I think it's safe to say, are generally supportive of the proposal, but they do have concern and quite frankly, oppose one aspect of the proposal, and that would be subsection D, which states that no deer breeding facility shall be allowed to utilize the provisions of this section more than once. Now, I should state that that is a provision that was put in here at the recommendation of both the Deer Breeder User Group and the Chronic Wasting Disease Task Force, both of which are stakeholder groups of this agency. They're comprised of permit holders, deer breeders agents. In the case of the CW Task Force, they're also comprised of some wildlife health professionals, veterinarians, whatnot. And they felt very strongly that this be a one-time provision, if you will. Now, keep in mind that during this discussion, we're really talking about the vast majority of the people that find themselves in this situation are here because, quite simply, they did not comply with existing testing requirements. And so there was some concern amongst these stakeholders that there could be continued noncompliance. This could be used to basically liquidate herds and then not comply with this testing plan, in the future. These stakeholders were not really taken into consideration when making this recommendation, and we're not considering what I believe these 11 commenters this morning are considering, which is those individuals who may be impacted by natural disasters, multiple natural disasters, maybe hit by multiple hurricanes and having large numbers of mortality as a result of that. And staff certainly don't have concern with allowing for somebody in that situation who lose large numbers of deer, beyond their control, to be able to take advantage of this if adopted by this commission and to be able to operate under a testing plan. Staff certainly would not have any concern with that. One other comment that I received this morning from the executive director of the Deer Breeders Corporation was that he's requesting that anybody who participates in this and operates under a testing plan, which again would require them to test 100% of the eligible aged animals in the herd one time, that facility be able to upgrade from a TC2 status to a TC1 status. This proposal does not speak to that. This proposal does not prevent that from happening. The existing rules would already allow that upgrade to occur if they test 100% of the animals. So again, this proposal does not change that, and I think would satisfy that public comment. So finally, I should state that staff do believe that it is critical that we maintain minimum testing standards to provide confidence that we're not inadvertently transmitting CWD throughout the state. But of course, as has been demonstrated time and time again, we strive to provide flexibility to help deer breeders meet these minimum standards. The proposal that this commission adopted last March and the proposal that you may consider for adoption tomorrow, both are attempts to provide that flexibility without compromising those minimum standards. It may be important to note that if these amendments are adopted, that there could be as many as 31 deer breeders who could choose to take advantage of these changes and perform the required disease surveillance to be able to transfer deer to release sites prior to the upcoming hunting season. Now, I should make this clear that those individuals I'm referring to right now, they already have the ability to get movement qualified under the rule amendments that you adopted last March. They just wouldn't be able to do so prior to this upcoming hunting season. It would, for most of them, be the hunting season afterwards before they could release these deer and then harvest those deer. This proposal could allow them to release deer potentially prior to the upcoming hunting season. A lot would have to fall into place for that to happen. Of course, that statement about them being able to release in time would depend on the capacity of the state wildlife veterinarian to even be able to draft that many testing plans in this short window. There's a lot of other things that would have to fall into place too, such as the permit holders being able to schedule a veterinarian to come out, collect the antemortem, conduct the antemortem testing, get test samples submitted to the laboratory, get test results back in time, all within less than a month from now would be the deadline to release those deer prior to the upcoming season. So with that, I'll conclude this presentation. I'll be glad to entertain any questions you might have.
Mitch, I've got a couple. I can look at this 95.5 or 99.5 or 99.1, and I see the burden it could place on a facility. But then I think, are we satisfied that a herd of 100 deer would have to reach 5 infections before you have a 99% chance of detecting it? That just seems like a big window. And I wonder, what would happen to one of the facilities if he did go to 99.1? What kind of a burden does that delay them time-wise by multiple years, or what is their solution there?
So the main burden would be, in my opinion, would be a financial burden, the cost of testing those deer. There's also some, it's the right way to put this. I mean, physically there's burden of this too. It requires some work to collect these samples. You know, it's 8 o'clock at night. Hunters are there at the skinning rack. Several deer are there getting tagged, et cetera, and they're pulling samples and they're ready to go pull steaks off the grill at the same time. So there's some burden to collecting these samples, and that burden would be extended over a longer period of time as more samples are collected. This rule would allow these samples to be collected over a number of years. This would not, though, keep in mind that deer breeders who are afforded this opportunity would be releasing deer. I mean, they're not still, right now, as the situation stands, they are not movement qualified, meaning they are not able to release deer from their facilities at all. They're just feeding deer in pens, spending money, and not being able to recover any, you know, receive any revenue to offset those costs while they're not movement qualified. This would allow them to at least get those deer out of the pens, into the pasture. They could be hunted. They could sell those hunts. It's just they would have to be tested, which does result in some burden and some financial burden.
They could move into the release pasture.
Into release pasture, yeah. That would agree to operate under a testing plan.
It just still seems like this is such an epizootic disease. It just seems like wouldn't they possibly have detected, if it's that prevalent in the herd, would they not detect it otherwise? I mean, visually, or it just seems
it's a good question.
The horse is out of the corral by the time you detect it.
That's a very good way of putting it, especially if we're trying to detect it, if we're waiting for it to reach high prevalence levels before we achieve a sufficient confidence to detect it. I just lost my train of thought, but I that's a valid concern, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
A couple of things, Mitch, because I'm still, I mean, obviously I've gone through the briefings recently, but a couple of numbers that you threw out that I wanted to just make sure I understood correctly. Currently, more than 90% of the breeders are movement qualified. Is that correct?
Either they are movement qualified or they are able to immediately regain movement qualified status by taking advantage of existing antemortem testing options.
Okay, so with that in mind, then the flip side of that is that the people that we're even more concerned with represent less than 10% of the is that a fair statement? Represent less than 10% of the breeders?
That is a fair statement.
Okay, then with that in mind, with the status, because the other thing I thought I understood through the briefing was that we don't fully understand the incubation period, and you know, in other words, this disease can be there and not necessarily be symptomatic for we don't know what period of time, and then all of a sudden it just kind of morphs into where we can actually identify it, and so that creates a certain level of we have a built-in level of uncertainty with even the stuff we have released, because the way it's identified through the testing process. Is that fair?
Yes, sir.
And so if we're looking, when we talked about the number of tests, you talked about the number of tests, but we didn't talk about the number of tests versus the size of the herd. So in other words, 91 tests, it didn't have to do with 91 out of 100. It sounded like 91 tests. I could have 500 deer, I could have 1,000 deer, I could have 92 deer. But I had to have 91 tests in this period of time to meet this level, 91 separately distinct tests to meet this level of certainty. Is that fair?
That's correct.
Okay.
And so if I may, I'd like to comment on that.
Go ahead.
The 91 test in this example would be assuming a population size, an infinite population number. So this is the way that these testing models work is you do increase the sample size increases as the herd size increases to a point.
Okay.
And then it flatlines at that point. And so basically, whether you have, and I don't know, well, I actually do have some numbers I can give you examples of, but I'll just pull something out of thin air for right now. If you, whether there's 5,000 deer in a population or 50,000 deer in a population, that sample size requirement would be the same at that point. It would be different if there's only 5 deer in the population, but in this example, we're assuming, in this proposal, we've designed it to try and keep it as simple as possible and not have a moving target across the board and just have the same requirement for everybody in this situation, and that's to assume an infinite population. Did I really confuse things there?
No, because what I was really trying to understand and this is not my area of expertise. So all I was really trying to understand is that for the number of people that might be upset, disgruntled, disappointed, disenfranchised, whatever term we might use with the rules, you also mentioned that there are 31 breeders that are currently not movement qualified that under these new rules could be movement qualified, but most likely because the window is really 30 days, that's not really likely to happen. So those people are probably, even with these changes, those folks are probably still not going to be happy. Is that they're not going to be back into the where they can be gaining revenue via their herd?
There's a number of people who are not movement qualified right now who are, this rule would still not allow to move deer prior to the upcoming hunting season for various reasons. You might recall that one of the aspects of this proposal is to allow for that whole herd antemortem test to occur at least 12 months after all animals in the herd have been documented. And the reason for that is it's very important that we know that we're dealing with a herd that has been closed, so to speak, for at least that 12-month period. Because as you stated, Commissioner, this disease doesn't just have a long incubation period, but it has a long period of what I'm going to call a latency period, a period of which the disease just isn't detectable by diagnostic test. And so we believe it's important that if the disease is in a facility, that the animals in that facility have had an opportunity to be exposed to that disease for a sufficient number of times so they actually do test positive. And so that's the reason for that 12-month requirement. There are some people who are in this situation whose herd inventories have been documented less than 12 months ago. And so they would not be able to call a veterinarian and come out tomorrow to do that test. Does that kind of address your comment?
So the documented herds, that if we amend this, that all eligible deer greater that have been there 12 months after the documented herd, if they could test and be released, which the ones that haven't met that requirement to date won't be for the hunting season, there is still a harvest requirement for any deer harvested that on those release sites, correct?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
If we pass this amendment and people could get movement qualified, you're saying that doesn't appear to be any that would be able to do it for this season, but say it's in the next hunting season, any deer that have been released onto the release site still have a harvest requirement, reporting harvest test, right?
So this, based on the data that I was able to acquire this week, it looks like that there could be as many as 31 deer breeders who potentially could take advantage of, if this is adopted tomorrow, who could take advantage of this and potentially be able to release deer within the next month and have those deer hunted this coming season.
Since it goes through January. Okay, but those release sites, we also in the rules have a harvest requirement reporting for any deer harvested off of those release sites?
So yes, ma'am. So anybody who would take advantage of this opportunity, that testing plan that I referred to applies primarily to the release site. And so this table that's on the screen before you is really illustrating the number of samples that would need to be collected from deer harvested on that release site. And so in order for us to be able to keep track of that, yes, there would not only be a harvest requirement, but there would be a record-keeping requirement, a harvest log, and then, of course, sample submission and test result submission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm certainly very new to this, don't know the full science, but a couple of clarifying questions. One, what is the cost per deer to conduct a live test?
With your permission, I'd like to go ahead and ask our state wildlife veterinarian, Dr. Dittmar, if he'll come up here and help answer that question. That cost is going to vary, I know, from practitioner to practitioner, but he's came from the private industry and can do a much better job addressing that.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Bob Dittmar. I'm the veterinarian for the Wildlife Division, Texas Parks and Wildlife. As Mitch just mentioned, that fee can vary widely. You're looking at, depending on the situation, some facilities have a working facility, which can facilitate collecting those samples much easier. Some places don't, so that's going to require sedation of those animals. It also the type of tissue collected will vary, will cause a variation in that too. Testing tonsils is going to require sedation. No matter what you do, it's going to require some technical skill, and it's going to require specialized instruments that are pretty expensive. So it's going to be more. So I'm dancing around your question, but it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 to $200 per animal. And that's a pretty broad estimate.
And if required, how long, what's the timing related to this testing? I know you're going to say it varies, but, I mean, is it something that could occur in 2 weeks, 2 months?
Yes, sir. From the time the sample's collected and with antemortem testing, we're required to use a specific type of test. The minimum for that from the time the lab gets it until they can actually run the test is going to be a week. But in actuality, because of the number of samples coming into the lab and depends on the time of the year and all these other factors on their workload, 2 weeks is going to be probably the very minimum. And, you know, realistically, 3 weeks to a month, depending if doing hunting season when there's lots of samples come in, probably longer than that. So it's going to be time consuming. And I guess from my standpoint, I'd like to point out that we're dealing with a very short time frame right now to get to the antler cutoff time in mid-September. to get all this enacted.
Okay, last question. What is the accuracy of the test?
Another excellent question, and it's another one of those. It depends on what we don't know. But the tonsil biopsy test is going to be very, very close to the sensitivity of the retropharyngeal lymph node. The rectal test is going to be considerably less than that, maybe somewhere around 50 to 75%. This is all dependent on the stage of the disease, the progression of the disease, and to a large degree the genetic makeup of that deer, because this disease has a genetic component as far as the progression of the disease. So we're comparing everything back to looking at, in white-tailed deer at least, the retropharyngeal lymph nodes, where we're going to find the prions in the disease first. So we're comparing back to that. Understanding, as has been pointed out several times, there's a latent period here that we cannot detect the disease when it's actually there. So,
okay, that's crystal clear to me.
I'm sorry, there's nothing about this disease that's very clear.
So the accuracy of the test is 50-50?
That's from an animal standpoint, that's probably, we're maybe better than 50-50.
Okay.
The other problem we have is, again, there's some technical skill required, particularly collecting the tonsil samples. And we have to, by the standard, have a certain number of follicles present in that sample. We're taking a little bite of a difficult place to get to. So we will also have a fair number of samples that are not valid. And that also confounds our results.
So last question, this one's a little more general, but as a professional subject matter expert, why would we not test 100% of the deer to guarantee ourselves? I mean, a 5% prevalence rate seems incredibly high. And so if we're testing 100% of the deer, I understand it's an economic burden, but, you know, this is a for-profit business, and deer breeders should integrate that into their cost structure.
And I'm gonna make sure I understand your question. We're not talking about testing 5%. We're looking at determining a 5% prevalence. That
understand, but he had a case where it's an infinite herd, and you're only testing 91.
Yes, sir, and that has to do with the statistical tables that would determine the odds of finding that disease by testing that number. And you want me to really confuse you, I'll attempt to explain how that works, and I'm not very good at it. But it's based on the percentage of animals that are positive. If you have a herd of 1,000 animals, you're going to have more animals in there if you have a 5% prevalence. So it's going to be easier to find that first one.
Okay.
So if I may, I'd like to clarify that this proposal would require 100% of the animals in the pasture on the release site that are harvested to be tested until this sample size goal is met. And so an example in the slide before you, 100% of the test eligible deer, or that are adult deer, if you will, until they have submitted 91 not detected test results. Because at some point, you know, I think most would agree that you got to draw the line somewhere, and so the question is where do we draw that line? Is it once we achieve a 99% confidence that we detected, if it's at a 5% prevalence or at a 2% prevalence or 95% confidence, et cetera? It's just where to draw the line, but it would be to test 100% of the deer, and again, we are talking about deer in the release site, in the pasture, not in the pens, until this sample size goal is met. In the pens, the deer breeders are required to test 80% of the adult mortalities that occur to maintain that movement qualified status. In fact, they even have to test a minimum number of deer in the facility in the event they don't have any mortalities, then they would use live animal tests to substitute for that. To also just expand a little bit on the question about dealing with accuracy and sensitivity of the tests, Commissioner Hildebrand, I talked about using live animal tests as substitutes for post-animal tests. If they miss one in the pen, it's August and they're gone for 3 days and the sample deteriorates, how do they get back to movement qualified? As I said, they can use live animal tests. I chose not to get into a level of detail to really confuse matters in this presentation, and I'll try not to now. But that substitution comes at a three-for-one trade, three live animal tests for that one missing postmortem. And the reason for that trade-off is because not only because the live animal test tissue is less sensitive than the postmortem, especially when we're talking about rectal samples compared to lymph node samples, but also because sampling deer that are seemingly healthy in the pen are not nearly as valuable as deer that come that die of natural causes in the pen. So for a variety of reasons, we require more live animal tests than postmortem tests. And then one other clarification I'd like to make, Commissioner Latimer, it was brought to my attention. I probably didn't fully understand or completely answer your question, and that is, if I understand correctly, if there's any deer breeders who are not movement qualified today who choose, if this rule is adopted and they choose not to avail themselves of this rule, of this new option, they would not be required to test in the pasture. In fact, if they took advantage of the rule adoption, the amendments that this commission adopted last March, which requires two whole herd tests at 12-month intervals, they would not be required to test animals on the release site after they're released. This is the only rule that we're discussing today that would require release site testing. Basically, I see some reactions there. The reason that we're proposing release site testing here is because, as Commissioner Chairman Morgan said, the horse is out. The horse is out of the barn. And so if we let the disease out, we want to try to detect it as soon as we can.
Reed, I got a question for you.
Go ahead, Rochelle.
The chairman's point about the horse being out of the barn is important to me, to all of us. And so we need to keep this in the pen and not in the release sites, in my opinion. So if I understand this, less than 10% of the people that are in this box, so to speak, did not comply with our regulations prior, and that's got them in this situation. And you mentioned that you and the staff have done everything they can to help with this, and I believe that as recent as March, you guys recommended criteria to come up with to help this less than 10%. That didn't comply in the past. And with the accuracy, as Jeff said, 50-50, maybe a little better, whatever it is, the technical skill, no one's shown me a reason why we would cut our standards that we already made available in March, why we would cut those standards in half again for such a dangerous disease. So, I think I understand where they are, but I haven't heard compelling reason to reduce our standards by that much. And I'm like some of the people, you know, I've talked about 5% seems very low. So I'm generally uncomfortable with what I'm hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I just have one more question. So the added burden to go from 99.5 to 99.1 is just the length of time that the deer breeder would have to continue to test until he got to that number, which is the financial burden. Is that correct?
Yes. He still may be able to achieve. Some people would be able to achieve this sample size goal of both the examples you just gave within one hunting season. Others, it would take multiple hunting seasons.
Well, I go back to Commissioner Hillenbrand's comment that this is a for-profit business, and I just think we have to err on the side of protecting the entire Texas deer herd. So unless I'm missing something, the added time and financial burden, while it's, I don't like to add a burden to anybody's business, it seems like that's the safest way to go, unless somebody else has a difference of opinion.
There is one thing that, based on a couple of comments I've heard, that I would like to clarify. Perhaps I've grown paranoid over the years of some of my statements being mischaracterized, and I don't mean by this commission. I mean outside. I want to clarify that, yes, less than 10% of the deer breeders in this state are not movement qualified and cannot get movement qualified very, very soon. It's not 100% of those are in that situation because of noncompliance. Some of those are in that situation. They did comply with requirements, but in some cases they released so many deer. In other words, they released all but a handful of deer from the facility that then they were not able, they did not leave enough deer in the facility to maintain that minimum, to achieve that minimum testing requirement through live animal testing. So not all of the people in here are, have been noncompliant with the rules, and I just want to clarify that for the record.
What percentage of that 10% are in that situation because of natural disasters?
Excellent question. I'm aware of one individual who's lost a large number of deer during Hurricane Harvey. I heard of a second, so we'll say possibly two. I'm not aware of anyone who has lost a lot or all of the deer to natural disaster who are in this situation today who wish to continue deer breeding.
And when you say lost, mortality or escape?
Mortality, most likely, all of them most likely died. I am aware of another individual, Commissioner, who has experienced anthrax in the facility and lost some deer, was recommended to not, by both our agency and Texas Animal Health Commission, to not submit samples from those deer because of the risk it could put that that individual would be faced with. And our CWD task force actually discussed this example, and while we agree that someone who's experienced multiple natural disasters might be able to take advantage of this multiple times for that reason, in the case of anthrax might not be a good example of that because preventative measures could be taken in that case to prevent
well,
that from
I have no this, we're getting off of the probability, but as far as the act of God, my personal opinion is that there ought to be an appeal process for a natural disaster, that not say they cannot use it again if they use it once. I just, a finite number doesn't appeal to me, but they have to apply and present evidence that there's been a natural disaster or act of God, which you can define.
Mr. Chairman, I think we can build that into the rules to allow for that option and for it to be reviewed again under a limited set of circumstances that fall under that kind of act of God rubric.
Yeah.
Mitch, one thing I don't know that was brought out quite strongly enough, with all the flooding that we had up here in the hill country, I know for a fact how many breeders and stuff lost lots of their herd, and they weren't killed, they just escaped water gaps and everything. So I don't know how you're how you're looking at that in all your statistics. But there were many, many deer that got out due to those massive floods, and we've had two of them.
Well, I appreciate that. That is news to me, Commissioner. But in that event, if they're reporting those escapes as required by regulation, then those deer would not be considered mortalities, and so they would not be in this situation as a result of that. They would still be movement qualified.
Just one final comment, Mitch. Obviously, you're standing in there doing the Lord's work here on a very, very tough topic. So I appreciate you being able to field all the questions and try to understand the concerns that each of us may have here, and that I think ultimately all the questions are just trying to make sure that we understand so we can get to the best possible resolution. I agree with the chairman that we're not trying to penalize anyone unnecessarily. You know, for some of it, I mean, we can use the term that it is a business, but still we're not trying to disadvantage anyone. We're just trying to look at if there is a, you know, the safety and health aspect of this, how can we best blend all of these things so we can have the safety, the health, and the business opportunity for people involved, so that it becomes a win all the way around, and that Texas ends up being better at the end of the day than worse off, if that's fair. So thank you.
Thank you.
So, Chairman, I think this really comes down to, we plan to present this proposal for a decision tomorrow, and so obviously you'll have the chance as a body to vote on whether or not you want to provide a third alternative of testing for, I think, again, what we've characterized as a fairly small universe of breeders that are in a situation that could take advantage of this. And then it really comes down to, we can integrate the act of God concern into it, but it really comes down to the risk tolerance. And so, do you want us to proceed with recommending the 95% confidence that we can pick it up at a 5% prevalence, or would you like us to propose something else tomorrow?
Well, right now we're at 99.5. Uh-huh. Yeah. If you could, tomorrow you could brief us on how big of a burden would this be for people to go to 99.2. I need to understand what kind of burden. And I'm not too concerned because it would interrupt their barbecue, but give us an idea about that tomorrow. Everybody agree with that?
So I think what you're looking for, Chairman, would be, you know, kind of the length of testing on average that somebody who availed themselves would have to go through, how many could get it done in 1 year versus multiple years.
Yes.
You know, certainly we could give you a variable range of costs associated with the tests that were, you know, conducted to meet whatever standard y'all want to go with. But it is going to be variable with respect to whether or not somebody could get all of these tests in 1 year, or if it might take them 2, 3, or 4 years. So it's going to be pretty individual specific.
Yeah, fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause I'm just uncomfortable with the 5%. I just think that's too big a delay in detecting the disease.
And I think that's what this question really comes down to, Chairman, for the commission, is what is your relative level of risk tolerance? And if the
zero,
and it's so, there are going to be a lot of tests, Chairman.
So let's work backwards from
okay.
that. What's,
right.
what's acceptable?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
And I think in fairness, Chairman, that's going to be in the eye of the beholder. And so ultimately it's going to be incumbent upon the commission to decide what your tolerance is. And again, this table gives us the best quantifiable example of how to approach that, again, with a unified standard. So right. Hearing that, do you want us to proceed with, we'll bring up the 99.5 again tomorrow, knowing that some of you are reflecting on that and you may want to modify that tomorrow, or do you want us to
yes.
change our, okay, got it.
Yes, Mr. Hibbert.
This one last question. So this relates to release sites, correct? And so answer the question, what is the likelihood a deer is released onto a ranch, it is shot for profit, what is the likelihood then that that sample is collected in this now disparate herd of deer across the state? How do we verify that that deer actually gets tested, or that hunter just puts it in the back of his pickup truck and hauls it home?
Well, that's a question of enforcement, Commissioner. And so, is Stormy King in the room here? He might be able to help address this question.
Stormy, you want to come forward?
Good morning. Stormy King, Assistant Commander, Wildlife Enforcement, Law Enforcement Division. Throw that question at me one more time, if you would, please, sir.
So a deer is sold to a commercial for-profit hunting ranch, and it's 300 miles away from where it was bred. The deer breeder sold 100 deer. What is the likelihood that those samples are collected from all of these various for-profit groups, and what is it just seems highly unlikely that those deer ever get tested. I mean, so the horse is out of the barn, to Commissioner Appling's point, and so I clearly would be more for testing these deer in the breeding pens, and that may be a very sophomoric approach to it, but I'm new to this, so I apologize.
That's all right. Well, in keeping with the theme of today, I'll say it varies. The nature of the business, the operation is going to have some impact on that. A lot of these facilities are likely releasing deer on site and have a very robust kind of a commercial hunting program, in which case they know to some extent when and what deer are going to be killed, so there is some control in that. As far as deer that are, as you mentioned, traversing across the state and being released onto more of what you would probably consider a picture as more of a wild condition, one factor is that under regulation now and statute, as of September 1st, all of those release sites are required to be high fenced. So we do have some level of at least perceived control in their movement. Fences wash away, deer jump fence. But we're relying upon the, in the containment zones and things like that. People are required by law to report and present those animals for testing. But to have any confidence overall that a deer is going to be harvested and tested, I mean, there's no way to say. It's my best answer.
So, again, Mitch Lockwood, Big Game Program Director. We do have some safety nets built in. They're not foolproof, but this proposal would require harvest logs to be maintained at the site of harvest. And so if a game warden were to show up and see seven deer hanging, he needs to see those seven deer logged into that harvest log. We could then later, once those harvest logs are submitted to the department after the hunting season concludes, we could then verify whether or not we have CWD test results for those deer in that harvest log. If you want to break the rules, you can, but I think there is a pretty good safety net put in place for everyone who's not intentionally trying to get around the rules.
And I'll apologize.
And Jeff, I want to clarify one thing that you brought up. You got to remember now that you've got two different situations. You got some deer being sold and moved to other sites, but then you have a whole lot of these people that basically raise them, turn them out, and sell the hunts themselves. So you're not dealing with everything scattered out, you know.
Remind me of the tattoo and tagging requirements. Which deer does that include?
Current rules require any breeder deer that's released from a breeding facility to have to be tattooed in the ear with a four-digit alphanumeric unique identification number. This proposal would require any deer released to be tagged, in addition to the tattoo, to be tagged with an RFID button tag, an electronic identification device. It's a button tag in the ear.
Any other questions or comments? Well, with that, I'll place the amendment to deer breeder regulations as amended to the regained movement qualified status. Recommended adoption of proposed changes for public comment tomorrow.
Thank you. And just to be clear, Chairman, is amended to integrate the act of God category, recognizing that you may revisit your risk tolerance threshold with respect to the confidence intervals.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch. Work session item 7, voter education fee rules. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Mr. Tim Spice and Mr. Cody Jones, please make your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Tim Spice. I am the Boating Education Manager for the Department. I am part of the Education Outreach Section, which is housed in the Communications Division. We are seeking to permission to publish proposed amendments that I'm going to discuss to the Texas Registry for public comment. A little history on voter education. 1997, a law was passed requiring mandatory education for primarily young people. If you remember back then, personal watercraft, jet skis were all the craze, and we were trying to mitigate some issues there. So the law had an exemption for anyone over 18 years of age. Then in 2011, the law was amended and primarily dropped that 18-year-old exemption and changed the born after date to 1993. That means today a person who's 26 years old, if they want to operate a powerboat on public waters in Texas, they have to take a boater education course approved by the department. A couple of the things that we're wanting to propose changes to are some provisions, some relic provisions that have changed over time, and a provision that requires the executive director to set up a service fee schedule. An example of some of those rules that are no longer necessary. There used to be a six-hour requirement for some national standards for education, and we used to have a home study course. If you remember back when, before the internet was so popular, and you got a VHS in the mail and you took a test and sent it back in, we haven't had anybody request one of those in a couple of years. So that's one change. And then we have a service fee schedule that has become outdated since we started in 1997 with the changes in the internet, and we are requesting to go to a free market model to so that providers can keep costs relatively low over a lifetime for a lifetime certification. We've determined that there are a number of easy and in some cases free options for people to obtain voter education. It's unnecessary to cap the amount of the service fee that a provider may charge for a customer or a Texan to take a voter education course. And a couple other of the proposed changes would be to eliminate, there's an exemption now for our online providers of a $10 fee that is sent into the agency required by code, that currently online providers retain that fee instead of sending it in and paying them back that same fee. As we implemented online courses, we with the cap that we had on there of $20, it was hard for them to do a course for $10, send us $10, and we had a difficulty taking that $10 and sending it back to them to provide the service. Roughly 85% of the people who take voter education in Texas take it online, and we currently have four online private providers that provide that service for our voters. And we also have a provision in there for enhanced courses. That definition of enhanced courses has changed over time. It used to be to provide a service for our partners, the Coast Guard Auxiliary and the Power Squadron, who offered courses through their programs. And now we have enhanced content for our online providers, and we want to offer boaters the opportunity to take an advanced, enhanced course online. So changing that language would help with that requirement. And we have an additional recommendation that I'm going to ask the Boating Law Administrator to come up and discuss that came about after we made some of those requests.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Cody Jones. I'm the Boating Law Administrator, part of the Law Enforcement Division. I'm just coming forward to you today to add some additional clarification to the administrative rule that we have in place. Recently, we had a call from the Coast Guard captain of the port in one of our ports. As Mr. Tim Spice had indicated, the current statute requires that anybody born on or after September 1st, 1993 must be a voter ed certified. The fact remains that the U.S. Coast Guard and many other military services have folks that are signing up for duty at that age limit, and their requirement to be on board a boat, to operate a boat in the military services, was not exempted by virtue of our statute. So the captain of the fort asked that we look at that as an exemption moving forward. So just for clarification, the current exemptions that are in place by statute are that the a holder of a master mate or operator's license issued by the United States Coast Guard, or a non-resident of the state that is operating in our state and has a certification from the other state that we recognize. So specifically, the master mate and operator's license are licenses that are given to commercial enterprises by the United States Coast Guard, but the Coast Guard does not give their officers inside the military organization those licenses. So specifically moving forward, we're looking to ask permission to add to the proposed amendments for publication, recommendation to exempt service members who serve as a qualified, have served, or are currently serving as a qualified officer of the deck underway, a boat coxswain, a boat officer, a watercraft operator, or a marine deck officer in any branch of the military forces of the United States or the Merchant Marines. In addition, we noted that as we exempt individuals that come from other states in the United States who are certified boater education, we exempt them in our state. But however, we have a reciprocity agreement nationally with the Canadian provinces. We would like to also include that someone that holds a Canadian pleasure craft operator's card be exempted from the requirements for boater education in our state as well. So with that, happy to answer any questions y'all may have, and I'll request your permission to publish the proposed changes.
I have one quick question. Just because you mentioned the reciprocity in Canada, and just as we talk about, we're looking at the north border, we look at the south border, is there any issue with Mexico having a similar thing that we should be looking at since we're looking at it right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent question, Commissioner. As it stands right now, the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators is a governing body that works with the United States Coast Guard, who has that reciprocity agreement with Canada. We don't currently have any working relationship with any of our southern countries that we can necessarily speak to. There is a UN resolution, Resolution 40, that the United States has not signed on to, nor have several other countries, but some European countries have signed on to that agreement that requires licensing of operators in their countries, and NASBOL is looking at that. So should the National Association accept those changes, we would likely come back to you and ask that anybody that falls under the UN 40 resolution would be accepted as a boater in our state as well. Yes, sir.
Any other further discussion? If not, I authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Work session item number 8, license possession rules regarding verification of hunting and fishing license information, implementation of the legislation passed during the 86th Texas Legislature relating to House Bill 547, recommended adoption of proposed changes.
Morning again. Good morning again. Stormer King, Assistant Commander Wildlife Enforcement for the Law Enforcement Division. This one should be pretty straightforward and clear-cut. As a result of House Bill 547 passed in the legislature the past session, the commission is now required to take some things into account when implementing or writing our regulations as in regard to proof of possession of a hunting or fishing license. Apply to recreational fishing, hunting, and combination license, and they will not apply to any types of commercial licenses, anything like that. The rules as developed, as proposed, address concerns with legibility and clarity of image, taking into account all the possible pitfalls of somebody showing you a picture of their hunting or fishing license. And these proposed changes to the rules will have no effect on tagging requirements or the possession of tags, endorsements as they currently stand. Basically, what it does is require us by rule to continue your practice that we've been doing for a while and making it more convenient for the public to provide proof of possessing a hunting or fishing license. Any questions?
Any questions or comments? No further discussion. I'll place the license possession rules regarding verification of hunting and fishing license information, implementation of legislation passed during the 86th Texas Legislature relating to House Bill 547, recommended adoption and proposed changes on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Work session item number 9, sand and gravel program rules regarding permit requirements, implementation of legislation passed during the 86th Texas Legislature relating to House Bill 2805, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Mr. Hager, please make your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Tom Hager. For the record, I administer the sand and gravel permit program in the Inland Fisheries Division. I'm here today to present proposed changes to the rules in Chapter 69 of the Texas Administrative Code, which pertain to administering the sand and gravel permit program. Under Chapter 86 of the Parks and Wildlife Code, the Parks and Wildlife Commission has the authority to regulate disturbance of and take of sedimentary materials within public waters of the state. And that includes the authority to issue permits for the issuance for the disturbance or take of material and the authority to collect royalties from commercial operations. The statute creating the sand and gravel program was originally passed in 1911. I mean, the program was intended to deal with the potential disturbance from the excavation of sand, gravel, marl, shell, and mud shell materials from Texas waters. And these materials were used, were the main source of construction aggregate back in the day, and they're still used to some degree today. Excavation of sediment from Texas waters has the potential to have adverse effects on fish and wildlife habitats, on water quality, and on the stability of streams and coastal waters. So the legislature at the time understood that there'd be these impacts, and therefore they designated that 75% of royalties would be dedicated to fish hatcheries in what may have been the first mitigation program in the state back in 1911. Currently, the sand and gravel program issues approximately 2 to 3 individual permits per year. These are larger projects that disturb or take more than 1,000 cubic yards of material. And these types of projects may be the commercial sand dredging operations in the lower Brazos. Examples would be removal of sedimentary material from Barton Springs Pool or restoration and recovery from flood deposits in waterways and that kind of a project. An average of 25 to 30 general permits are issued per year, and these are smaller projects, less than 1,000 cubic yards. And examples would be removal of sediments from road crossings, bank stabilizations, pipeline crossings, and projects like that. The jurisdiction over sand and gravel extends to public freshwater areas, including navigable streams and perennial streams that lie within what were originally Spanish and Mexican land grants. Jurisdiction also extends to tidewater limits of the state, including coastal waters up to the mean high tide line and Gulf waters offshore to 3 marine leagues, which is Texas territorial waters. And the rules also include exemptions for some types of projects, particularly those that would restore or maintain the capacity of existing public water supplies, projects to maintain or build public utilities lines when they're done by public utilities, and projects that are public road projects from TxDOT. In 2019, the legislature enacted House Bill 2805, which amended Parks and Wildlife Code Chapter 86, which governs the department's authority to issue sand and gravel permits. And the changes in 2805 include requiring that there be a single application form for individual and general permits. Currently, there's a separate type of form for each of those two permits. The statute also requires that all applications provide the same information, whether they're for a general or an individual application, and that that information had to include information on publication of public notice, and it required notice in both the newspaper of greater circulation in the county as well as the newspaper from the community nearest the project. The statute requires that proof of notice that proof that notice was mailed by certified mail is sent to landowners along shore, a mile upstream and downstream from a proposed project. Currently, notice is mailed by the department, but only on individual permit applications and only half a mile up and downstream. The statute required an approved sediment impact assessment for all applications. Currently, a sediment impact assessment is only required for an individual permit application and only on a state-owned waterway. Also required was an amendment that any amendments to a permit be listed in the application for any application that's for a renewal of an existing permit. Further, the statute required a maximum term limit of 1 year for general permits, and currently that maximum term limit is 3 years. Required a final report of sedimentary material removed for all permits, and currently there's not a requirement for a final report. It also requires that rules be generated regarding the delivery and the format of that final report. And it finally required a new exemption from permitting for projects that are non-commercial, remove less than 125 cubic yards within a year, remove only unconsolidated materials, and remove from on-channel impoundments that were created prior to 1956. So therefore, these statutory changes require some changes to the sand and gravel rules in Chapter 69, and therefore the following rule changes are proposed. First, the proposed change to the definition in 69.102, changing the definition of a general permit to reflect the regulatory criteria listed in the rules, as opposed to the current definition, which simply defines them as simply insignificant. Proposed changes to 69.105 would implement many of the requirements for applications, including establishing one set of criteria for all permit applications, require one application form for all applications as well, establish a newspaper notice requirements as required, require documentation of sending notice by certified mail for all applications, require a sediment impact assessment for all applications, and require the requested permit amendments for all permit renewal applications. And these are all as required by House Bill 2805. Proposed changes to 69.108 would delete existing sediment study requirements in this section because they would conflict with the new proposed sediment study requirements that are required by 2805. Proposed changes to 69.110 would limit general permits to a maximum term limit of 1 year as required. They would also clarify that the existing 3-year maximum permit for individual permits would remain because House Bill 2805 did not address individual permits, so we're not proposing a change to the limits there. Proposed changes to 69.111 would clarify various requirements for individual permits. Commercial operations come with requirements for having bonding, providing royalties, and various monthly reporting. And those would be specifically notified or pointed out in this section. Changes to this section would also require a final report as required for sediment volume removed for all permits, would establish delivery and format criteria for that final report, and would retain an option for interim reporting requirement by for general permits. There's currently language allowing the department to require interim reports on general permits, and that would be moved and consolidated into this section. Proposed changes to 69.114 would simply clarify that fees in this section apply to individual permits only, there's no proposed change to the fee amounts themselves. Proposed changes to 69.117 would delete some general permit notification requirements in this section because they would have been combined and consolidated into 69.105 as previously described. But also a change here would establish a requirement for department approval of emergency activities, because currently there's no language in the rule that addresses the department's ability to review a proposal or evaluate a claim of emergency need or emergency activity. And finally, within there, changes to clarify the report requirement again applies also to emergency situations. The same possible requirement for interim reports that applies to general and individual permits. Proposed changes to 69.118 would again clarify language simply to indicate that this section refers to all permits rather than just general permits like it does now, and reflect that 69.117 would no longer refer to general permits as previously described. Changes to 69.119 would clarify language referring to general permit application fee, and again, no proposed change to the fee itself is no change to the fee itself is proposed. Proposed changes to 69.120 would add that required exemption for certain on-channel impoundments as described previously. One public comment has been received, and it was in favor of the proposal, and no other comments have been received. So if I'd entertain any questions at this time, thank you.
Any questions by the commissioners? Yes.
How are the fees determined for the individual permit?
The fee schedule is in, I forget the section number, but it's in the section. It's basically a flat $1,200 application fee for a commercial permit, and it's $500 for an individual permit that's not a commercial permit.
Thank you.
There's no further discussion. I will place the sand and gravel program rules regarding permit requirements, implementation of legislation passed during the 86th Texas Legislature relating to House Bill 2805, recommended adoption of proposed changes on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action.
Thank you.
With regard to work session item number 10, local parks and outreach grant scoring rules, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments? Because if not, I'll place the local parks and outreach grants scoring rules, recommended adoption of proposed changes on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Work session item number 11, exchange of easements, El Paso County, approximately 3.5 acres of Franklin Mountain State Park. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments? If not, I will place the exchange of easements, El Paso County, approximately 3.5 acres at Franklin Mountain State Park on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Work session item number 11, exchange of easements, El Paso County, approximately 3.5 acres at Franklin Mountain State Park. Wait a minute. Sorry. Didn't turn the page. With regard to work session item number 12, acquisition of land, Bastrop County, approximately 19 acres at Bastrop State Park. Does any commissioner have any question or comments? If not, I'll place the acquisition of land, Bastrop County, approximately 19 acres at Bastrop State Park on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Work session item number 13, acquisition of land, Starr County, approximately 147 acres at Falcon State Park. Mr. Trey Vick, please make your presentation.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, commissioners, new commissioners, welcome. For the record, my name is Trey Vick. I'm with the Land Conservation Program, and I'm here today to present to you an acquisition of land in Starr County, approximately 147 acres at Falcon State Park. Falcon State Park sits in Starr and Zapata counties. It's about 22 miles northwest of Rio Grande City. Falcon State Park consists of about 576 acres in Starnes, Pata counties. It sits at the southern end of Falcon International Reservoir, which is an 84,000-acre reservoir straddling the Texas and Mexico border. It was formed by damming up the Rio Grande River. Falcon Dam was dedicated in 1953 by both U.S. and Mexico presidents. The state received the land for the park from the International Boundary and Water Commission in 1949, and the park was opened in 1965. Staff is in negotiations to acquire approximately 147-acre tract adjacent to the park boundary that sits in Starr County. This proposed acquisition would add critical habitat, provide the park additional buffer from commercial and residential development. It would also allow for a new trail system and would expand recreational opportunities for the park. Here's a overall picture of the park. The current park boundary is outlined in red. The 147-acre tract is outlined in green. We've received three comments, all in favor of this transaction. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I have one question.
Sure.
From the park to the water, is that land owned by the International Border?
I believe this picture was taken when the lake was really down.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
During the drought.
All right. Any questions or comments? Commissioner?
Rodney, State Parks Director, believes so. I can clarify that and have that answer for you tomorrow for the meeting.
In the picture, it looks like a long ways.
It does.
Now, I'm kind of looking carefully at the pictures. Is there going to be a landlocked, maybe a drilling location, kind of in the corner of the green?
Those two sites have improvements on them that we weren't interested in acquiring. So we cut around that as part of the negotiations.
And then access would have to be built.
It has access along the county road that runs to the on the east side of the picture, and then the park road on the north side of the picture.
Right. Okay.
Commissioner Hildebrand.
What is the methodology to determine value? Do you have an appraiser? And
yes, sir. Right now we have a letter of intent with the estate that owns the property. The value is going to be either confirmed or determined by an appraiser, Yellow Book Federal Appraisal that we have engaged right now.
And the regulations don't allow you to pay in excess of the appraised value. Is that correct? Or do they?
Is that?
Bob, you want to answer that? I think we have some latitude, Commissioner, on that front. Obviously, we try to adhere to not paying more than appraised price, appraised value, but there may be circumstances in which we think the circumstances warrant. Is that fair, Bob?
I think that's right, Mr. Executive Director. I'm Bob Sweeney, the General Counsel. Right, we don't have a specific regulation of our own that says we can't pay more than appraised value. In this case, correct me if I'm wrong, Trey, this is LWCF. So this is Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund funding. So we've got this is the primary source of acquisition dollars is the federal program. And in that regard, we're operating under their restrictions.
Okay, but under a standard process as a state agency, you've got to go through a process to appraise. And it's my understanding with some previous work that we could not, as a state agency, can't pay more than the appraised value, but maybe we're mixing words here, but you're saying this falls under some other program.
This particular acquisition, yes, is under the Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund.
Got it. Okay.
Program.
All right, thanks. All right.
But, Commissioner, just to be clear, we don't make it a habit of paying more than appraised value, even though that flexibility may exist for the commission. If there were to be some project in which the cost was going to be more than appraised value, we would certainly notify the commission, and you would have a decision about whether or not you wanted to proceed.
Any further questions by the commission? If not, I will place the acquisition of land Starr County, approximately 147 acres at Falcon State Park, on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. With regard to work session item number 14, acquisition of land Cameron County, approximately 17 acres at the Longoria unit of the Las Palomas Wildlife Management Area, does any commissioner have any questions? If not, I'll place the acquisition of land Cameron County, approximately 17 acres at the Longoria unit of the Las Palomas Wildlife Management Area, on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Work session item number 15, grant of easement, Brazoria County, approximately 66 acres at the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area. Request permission to begin the public notice and input process. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth, please make your presentation.
Chairman, commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. For those of you that are new, welcome. The Land Conservation Program is housed within the Infrastructure Division, and we are essentially responsible for all things real estate. We're responsible for acquisitions, dispositions, easements, surface use agreements, leases, licenses, boundary disputes, working with the General Land Office to negotiate oil and gas activity that occur on or under our properties. This morning I'm bringing a request for an easement at the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area. We're asking for permission to begin the public notice and input process. The Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area is in southeast Texas in Brazoria County, frontage on the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway, and just immediately south of Lake Jackson and immediately west of Freeport. As such, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's in the way, but it's an obvious target when it comes to pipelines that feed the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, that feed a number of oil and gas-related industries, petrochemical industries associated with the Port of Freeport. And so this is, those of you who have been with us for a while know that requests for easements at the Justin Hurst are not that uncommon. It's about 14,734 acres of coastal prairies, bottomland hardwood forests, and wetlands. The Wildlife Management Area have a very significant conservation value. As you can see, it's a very large contiguous area of coastal habitat in an area that's experiencing a lot of development pressure. Attracts a lot, as you can imagine, a lot of waterfowl, shorebirds, wading birds, but also a lot of reptiles, amphibians, and other coastal wildlife. It's bounded by the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway, as I mentioned earlier, and by commercial and industrial and residential lands to the north and to the east. We've been approached by CenterPoint Energy. They proposed to construct a new 345 kilovolt electric transmission line from the Bailey substation in Wharton County, basically northwest of the area, to the Jones Creek substation in Brazoria County, east of the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area. They evaluated a number of routes, submitted evaluations of those routes to the Public Utility Commission. We reviewed those. A number of those did cross the Wildlife Management Area, and the one that ended up being the preferred route does cross the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area. The length of the requested easement across the WMA is 5.4 miles at 100 feet in width. That's a 66-acre easement. It's a significant easement. And you can see in this map that it pretty much straddles the Wildlife Management Area all the way from west to east on the north end there. Again, what we're doing today is requesting permission to begin the public notice and input process. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I believe this is you're going to have an opportunity to discuss this in executive session today.
Ted, I assume that you're using our standard rate fee structure for this right of way?
Yes, sir, we are. We've put those numbers to paper. We're prepared to share those with you in executive session. But that's where we are at this point in negotiation. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
It, it parallels an existing transmission line. Where would that be on the map?
It parallels actually two transmission lines that are adjacent to each other that are on the north side of where this new, immediately north and parallel and run the full length of the WMA.
This will be heard in executive session. Work session item 16, litigation update, will be heard in executive session. Work session item 17, performance evaluation of the Parks and Wildlife Department Executive Director, will be held in executive session. Therefore, at this time, I would like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of seeking legal advice under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act, including advice regarding pending or contemplated litigation, deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Open Meetings Act, and delivering an evaluation of personnel under Section 551.074 of the Texas Open Meetings Act. We will now recess for the executive session at 11:36. Okay, we're all present. I'm going to call the annual public hearing to order August 21st, 2019 at 208, excuse me. Now, everybody please rise for the presentation of the colors by the Texas Buffalo Soldier.
Detail, 10 hut. Permission to post colors, sir.
Permission granted.
Eldar Post.
Forward.
Thank you. Please be seated. It's a wonderful tradition we have here once a year at the annual meeting. For those of you in the audience who may not be familiar with the Buffalo Soldier program, Buffalo Soldier was a name given to the African-American troops of the United States Army as they served on the Western frontier in the late 1800s. Since 1995, the Parks and Wildlife Buffalo Soldier Program has served as an outreach program of the State Parks Division dedicated to sharing a unique and often overlooked piece of African-American history and other untold stories of our multi-ethnic past. The program provides educational and interpretive experiences that connect underrepresented populations with Texas State Parks through heritage interpretation. This is our annual public hearing, and before proceeding with any further business, Mr. Smith, I believe you have a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. Mr. Chairman, I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. I just want to join you in welcoming everybody to our annual public hearing. It's terrific that so many of you have come to visit and speak to the commission, and so we're thrilled to have you. It's a wonderful opportunity for our commission to hear from stakeholders and constituents and partners and collaborators from all over the state who have an interest in the business and work of this body. And so thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here. Just as a quick reminder, for those of you who do want to speak to the commission this afternoon, I want to remind you, if you haven't already, to sign up outside. At the appropriate time, the chairman will call your name and then the person on deck to come forward. When it's your turn to speak, please come up to the podium, and you'll have 2 minutes to address the commission about any topic germane to the work of the department. And if there's some specific follow-up that the commission has for us, they'll either ask us to follow up with you at another time or perhaps later today. But again, we're thrilled to have you here, and thanks for joining us for the annual public hearing. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. And again, we welcome the opportunity to hear from our constituents and look forward to your comments. If I mispronounce anybody's name, please correct it, not just for me, but also for the record. I'll do my best. And the first person we have is Madeline Brogan with Andres Hefferty on deck.
Hello, my name is Madeline Brogan. I'm from Georgetown, Texas, and I'm 15 years old. I've attended the Rolling Plains Bobeye Brigade for 3 years, North Texas Buckskin Brigade for 2 years, and Ranch Brigade for this summer. I would like to thank the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commissioners and staff for your support towards the Texas Brigades and for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. My Texas Brigades experience started 7 years ago when my older brother attended the 18th Battalion of the Rolling Plains Bobeye Brigade. I always heard my brother and sister talking about their great experiences and talking about all the fun things they've learned. I grew up watching my brother and sister marching in call cadences around the house, and so I decided right then that I wanted to attend one of these camps when I was old enough. Turns out marching was one of my favorite parts about camp. The Texas Brigades has allowed me to further my knowledge in wildlife and conservation and has given me the skills to talk with you today. I have grown tremendously as a land steward by applying the knowledge I have learned while at camp to my everyday life. At each camp, they teach you everything you need to know about the camp's specific species. One of my favorite parts of camp that they often have in common is learning plants and grasses, beneficial to each species. Now when I drive down the road to school or driving around a ranch, I randomly shout out different plant species that I see on the side of the road, which is probably distracting to the driver. Learning about quail, deer, and livestock have opened my eyes to a whole new perspective. I've realized that it is our duty to take care of them and the environment they all live in. The Texas Brigades camps have given me the knowledge to do so. Thanks to my great experience with the Texas Brigades, I found out what I am truly passionate about and what I care for, taking care of our environment and the animals that live in them. Again, thank you so much for your support towards the Texas Brigades over the years. Without y'all's help, the camps would not be the same. Thank you for allowing me to come and talk to you about my camp experience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, sir, and good afternoon to everybody. So I have attended the 21st Battalion of South Texas Bobeye Brigade and the 14th Battalion of Bass Brigade. And in this, I've learned several things, not just about hunting and fishing, but about conservation and leadership and public speaking. All of these, to me, have been great skills, and I just envy the skills that everybody else has. And I felt that I should be able to get up to those skills. So I eventually went to these camps after hearing about it from my brother, who attended Coastal Brigade. And after these camps, I truly progressed. So at my second camp, I took more of a leadership role, and I decided to start working harder because what I learned from the first camp, which was Bobeye Brigade. And at this second camp, I went home with Top Cadet. And after going home with Top Cadet, I realized that if you worked hard enough, you'd really come out with a prize. But also, I learned the role that Texas Parks and Wildlife has in helping make these camps successful. They truly, truly help with teaching these children, and without their help, I truly think that the facts that are brought across to these kids wouldn't really be there without Texas Parks and Wildlife. And help of professionals also helps. So people like Mr. Gary Klein, who is a professional angler, also helped a lot with the camp and teaching us things like tournaments and fish care. That all went with Mr. Gary Klein. And it was truly all just from the help of TPWD and professionals and other people who play a role in brigades. So, yeah, I truly think that TPWD has done a lot for brigades. And that's about my experience.
Well, we love to have the feedback. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have Roy Leslie with Sandy Sachs on deck.
Good afternoon. My name is Roy Leslie, and I just represent myself. My first topic is consequences. If I'm spotlighting on old Highway 9 and David Langford hears a shot, calls the law, and the Kendall County game warden catches me dragging a buck under the fence, here are the consequences I face. I lose the venison, the antlers, my rifle, my hunting license, my truck, and I face a stinging fine. If I'm a deer breeder and allow feedlot deer to escape or go missing, I still have my permits, my deer pens, and it faced zero consequences. No violator or serial violator was held accountable between 2004 and my January 2019 open records request. 11,689 deer. I'd present that poachers pose a lesser threat to our wild native white-tailed deer than irresponsible deer breeders. No consequences. Please correct this in the name of protecting our native wildlife deer from the spread of chronic wasting. My second topic is the need for a current statewide survey of exotic animals. The last Parks and Wildlife count was published in 1995. For Kendall, my county, that study showed zero free-range axis. Next door in Kerr County, the free-range estimate was 6,000. Axis invaded our low-fence ranch in Kendall before that. The data was incomplete. I'd ask that Parks and Wildlife begin work on an exotic census. Axis numbers are climbing rapidly. They're a growing threat to native habitat and wildlife. There's an easy way to gather thousands of data points. More than 11,000 Texans hold managed land permits. We must annually report all exotic kills. For a few lines of code, ask us how many we have. This won't square with traditional methods, but with thousands of entries, accuracy would rival the guesses and projections of 1995. It's free, it's mandatory, and it's available every April 1st. Please consider a statewide exotic census, and let's hold deer breeders accountable for allowing over 11,000 deer to escape or go missing. Thanks.
I've got just a quick question for you.
Sorry.
One table is escaped breeder deer, and the other one is breeder deer determined to be missing. Are they separate?
There is a separate page in there that explains that a little bit. Escaped are numbers that are actually, by law, required from the breeders. They furnish those numbers. And missing and unaccounted for comes from surveys, on-the-ground surveys by Parks and Wildlife. That's the actual physical count. They try to do that every 2 years, but it doesn't always happen that way. So there are two. The escape numbers come from breeders themselves. The missing and unaccounted for come from Parks and Wildlife physical counts.
Well, in 2014, there were 1,098 determined to be missing. Does that include the 127 that were reported as escaped?
No.
Okay. So it's added to it.
Kind of scary, isn't it?
Okay. Thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. Sandy Sachs, excuse me.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to address the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission today. I'm here as a friend of the environment and the wildlife at Lake McQueenie. It's a little lake south of New Braunfels, and it's part of the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority. We have been advised that the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, along with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, have advised a plan to dewater the lakes of the Guadalupe and those lakes south of New Braunfels. This plan claims to dewater these lakes with minimal impact to our environment and wildlife. Although I believe that this is not a irrevocable decision, I do believe it could be an irreversible impact on the wildlife and the environment in that area. And all I'm asking for today is a copy of the plan and the environmental study that was done. Thank you.
Thank you.
By this department. Thank you.
Carter, we have five people. Do you want to address Ms. Sachs' comments, or do you want to listen to all five?
Well, why don't we listen to all five, Chairman, and then I'm happy to respond. Or if you'd prefer to me to make a statement about it now with Craig, I'm happy to set the stage because I am concerned about some misinformation. That
I think we ought to clear that up first.
Okay, sure.
And
then we can follow up with information that people have. And I do want to be abundantly clear. Parks and Wildlife has absolutely no regulatory or management authority over the operation and management of the dams or water levels of the affected reservoirs by this decision. So I want to make sure everybody knows Parks and Wildlife was not part of a decision-making body with respect to that decision that was announced last week by the GBRA Board of Directors. We do have responsibilities, obviously, to protect the fish and wildlife resources within those water bodies. And the way that we work with public entities that are dewatering large lakes or reservoirs is to develop aquatic resources relocation plan. And that is something that our biologists are in the throes of working on right now. And obviously it seeks to avoid and minimize impacts to the extent practicable. And if that's not viable, then to help identify ways to mitigate those actions with future activities. And so our biologists are now actively in the throes along those series of lakes, looking at habitat mapping of different structural features in the lakes, looking at ways to protect things like stumps and other structures within the lake, trying to provide counsel and advice to the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority about their rate of drawdown so that fish and mussels and other species affected by this would have some chance to be able to get back into the main stem of the river. Where necessary, obviously, we're working to help provide recommendations for the rescue and relocation of organisms that are going to be affected by the drawdowns. And we're certainly going to have recommendations about what GBRA can do in the future to help restore habitats within those lakes once those dams are rebuilt. And so, again, our role in this is very specifically limited to, again, this aquatic resource relocation plan. And I want to be abundantly clear about that to all of the rightfully concerned stakeholders along those lakes. That plan is not finalized, but obviously we are more than happy to share that when it is. Chairman, I guess that's probably a good overarching statement just to clarify our role and to make it abundantly clear what we're involved in and, just as importantly, what we're not involved in. Because I too, saw a press release that suggested that Parks and Wildlife was either part of that decision or was consulted on that decision. I'm not sure that was as artfully worded as it could have been to reflect the level of cooperation that we have on a certain slice of this. Is that Craig, did I miss anything with
please
respect to that summary?
Can
I have a question after that?
Yes, please.
I understand. So you are doing a study, and you are studying the lakes and mapping out the different environmental issues that I'm sure you think we are concerned with also. What are we doing to preserve all our options, and what can we do to possibly not begin draining the lakes in the next 3 weeks, because then if you find out something that is irreversibly damaging our habitat, we have a problem.
Sure. No, and I completely understand that, ma'am. I will say that is the decision-making body for that question is the Board of Directors for the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority. And so that question really has to be directed at the GBRA board. Craig, if there's any other issues that I'm missing here with respect to our monitoring and the plan that we're putting together, let me know. But the decision-making body is the GBRA board.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had no input and no previous knowledge that it was going to occur.
But I believe that the Texas Parks and Wildlife is about preserving wildlife and environment.
We are.
If we do believe that something is going to happen, what action do you normally take to preserve options or to keep this from happening? What authorities do you have? I know you can't control what they do, but what authority do you have to protect the wildlife and environment? Do you have any?
Sure, and that's a great question, and there's a whole array of authorities. Unfortunately, they don't help a lot with respect to the specific issue that you're concerned about with the complete drawdown and dewatering of those lakes and the water back to the main stem of the channel. The authorities that we have is to work with the GBRA, in which they are coordinating with us on, to the extent possible in this situation, to try to minimize the impacts. Obviously, there are going to be impacts. We want to be clear about that. And then to work with them on trying to restore features and structures and restocking of those lakes once those dams are replaced or rebuilt or repaired.
You keep saying that when the dams are rebuilt, is there a plan for that?
I don't know.
Okay.
I may have misspoke. Whether it's repaired, rebuilt, whatever the
right. But once the water is kept at a level again, or that the water is sold again, and which is what GBRA does, selling the waters, and that's what I was wondering. If you wait 3 years, there's different impact
sure.
than there is if you drain the lakes for 6 months.
Right.
And
right.
So. I didn't know if this commission has enough authority to say, well, no, you cannot impact this wildlife forever.
We do not.
Okay.
We do not. Yeah, no, and I really appreciate your coming and giving us a chance to respond. I hear your concerns loudly and clearly. We want to do our part providing the best possible technical information to GBRA to consider while they're drawing down the lakes and once they go back to filling them up, which is hopefully sooner rather than later. But I don't want to pretend that there are not impacts on the people around it and obviously the fish and wildlife communities that depend upon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay, we have Robin Rush and Dr. Judy Owens up.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm here as a 26-year resident of Guadalupe County and representing myself. My family and myself have been in the New Braunfels city area for many years. We just received the emergency. You said you weren't aware. None of us were really aware the lakes were going to be drawn down until 2 weeks ago is when the notice went out. This is a 90, for those that don't know, this is a 90-plus-year-old system of lakes and rivers, of the Guadalupe River Basin of lakes. I've never seen a planned exercise that doesn't require a proper amount of impact studies done before it's ever done. I don't believe the census and the mitigation efforts that you guys are assisting GBRA is the proper avenue to follow. I also believe that the state of Texas and Parks and Wildlife would be very concerned if endangered species, which there are on your list, TPWDs, and protected species are going to be killed and the environment and the habitat with which they're there will not exist anymore. At this point, it will not exist anymore. There is no money. There is no dams to be rebuilt. They have cited safety as a primary reason. I submit to you that that is just a red herring, that the areas they're citing, the safety is the failure of the gates. There's two gates that have failed on two lakes in less than 10 years. The river went up 6 inches a foot. Nobody was hurt, and they're not going to get hurt unless they're playing on the dams, which are restricted areas to begin with. They said, well, the canoers break the law and go up to the dams. There is no reason to endanger this habitat until the proper environmental and economic studies are done. You guys have the authority to protect the wildlife. I believe that a 90-year system of lakes and rivers comes under your jurisdiction of these. There's three species that are threatened and endangered for sure that I found out in the last week or two. One of them is the, I think I gave you, there's a document you should have in front of you. There's a Kegel Maps turtle, which is endangered and protected under TPWD. It's enlisted as a red list endangered species. It's only found in this Guadalupe River Basin area. It's not found anywhere else. I think it used to be in the San Antonio system, but they haven't found them in a long time. There's two clams that are threatened for sure. In fact, they did a study. They were out there in July, your guys were, with the Fish and Wild, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, as well as with GBRA, and they found a bunch of dead pimplebacks. You're going to kill off the pimplebacks, which are threatened, except for what exists there in the minor part of the river. You're not going to be able to reverse this. If I were you, and I'm not, I would demand that GBRA do a proper environmental and economic impact study to this before they do it. There is no compelling reason. You're going to kill more people and hurt more kids that fall off the docks that are 15 feet tall. If you go to Lake Dunlop, they're 15 feet in the air in their backyard. They're going to fall off and break their necks. You're not going to hurt anybody with that dam. All three gates are not going to break. They're not going to break. They said they're going to, well, what happens if all three gates? Well, there's concrete between each gate. You're going to lose a gate. And it's an area below and above the dam where nobody goes. And they're not supposed to be there. If you want to go jump off Hoover Dam, go jump off it. But anyway, I really appreciate your time. I think that this is one of the proper venues for somebody to say, hey, we don't want to threaten species that we've actually are protecting. You know, you guys do a fantastic job. This is a 90-year system of things you've protected. Please have them do the right thing, which is they should do a proper environmental impact study. They should mitigate all these things prior to doing something like this. This is haphazard and wanton. So,
thank you. We understand your passion. And
well, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer, but there's a document there that can help you.
Yeah.
But I think you will find you probably do have the authority of the state of Texas to stop it. So,
we'll.
And at least do it in a proper manner. So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, guys.
Dr. Owens.
Yeah, she's going to talk a little bit about the species. So,
and Gib Heffernick is up next.
Nope. I thought you said
Dr. Owens. Yeah.
Dr. Owens. Yeah.
Heffernick.
I first of all I want to thank the commission for giving us the opportunity to speak and have our concerns heard. And I understand that you're not able to override what GBRA is saying and what their board's plans are. And we're not asking for an override, but I think that this is something that once the action takes place, we're going to lose species. We have a Kegels. If you took turn to the page, let's see. There's a map on here, page 5. The Kegel's map turtle is a turtle that is protected by, do you have the document I'm looking at? It's like this on the front cover. Okay. And on page 5, there's a map. And it shows where the turtle has historically been. This is a turtle that is protected by the state of Texas. And it historically was in the San Antonio River Basin and the Guadalupe River Basin. And it's no longer believed to be present in the San Antonio River Basin. And these have been seen as recently as I saw one yesterday in the Guadalupe River Basin. And they live in the canals and along Lake McQueenie. If we don't evaluate first, if we don't have a proper impact study, we're not going to know what we're losing. And I encourage this organization to insist or put forth pressure on knowing what we're going to do, knowing what is it we're even going to lose. We have mussel species that are endangered. We have the turtle species that's a protected species that's endangered. The mussels are threatened and the turtle's endangered, let me correct. But we're not going to know what we're going to lose unless we do it first. If we wait until the lakes are drained, then we don't even know what's going on. And there's no study that's been available for public review. We would, you know, just to know what's been done. We hear that, you know, there's some surveys. We see surveyors out on the lake, but none of that has been open for public record. And delaying the dewatering of these lakes until proper evaluation can be done, I think, is the only responsible way to move forward. Questions?
Thank you, Dr. Owens.
Thank you.
Gib Heffernick and Tom Goins?
Goins.
My name is Gib Heffernick. I'm from San Antonio, Texas. Proposal that the following dams owned by GBRA, Dunlap, McQueenie, Placid, Meadow, Gonzales, and Wood be modified and cut down in the height done at Rio Vista Dam in San Marcos, Texas. Separate but not owned by GBRA would include M.A. Wade Dam and the City of Gonzales Dam. By doing that, you would create 8 whitewater venues. If you do that, you should plan for seating and restroom attendance for 2,000 people at each venue, expandable to 5,000. You should have portage trails on each rapid, and you should have parking and put-in at each of these takeout points. Three linear parks can be created using the surface reservoirs of these lakes, of Dunlap, McQueenie, Placid, and Meadow. You could have a 40-mile linear trail from Seguin to Gonzales, and the acreage of 1,157 acres equals to the 50th largest state park in Texas. If you combine the acreage of Lake Gonzales and Lake Wood, it's equal to the acreage of the 50th largest state park in Texas. This system enhances the natural aeration of water policy for your water suppliers, and by building catchment basins along the sides of the river, you enhance the river for clarification and retention. The benefits of this are it restores the property values with a long-term plan instead of a questionable and expensive repair. It's an economic solution that's in line with the tourism and recreational values in the Bronzeville. The available revenues for such a project are through private, local, state, and federal use. It creates a tourist destination spot for Texas, U.S., and abroad. It's a year-round venue open all the time. It also enhances and brings about restoration of the river to a natural state. I am recommending as an action plan that you form a task force of all concerned parties to evaluate the potential of this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to follow Gib. I'm Tom Goins. I'm president of the Texas Rivers Protection Association. So that if he did get shot while talking about removing these dams, I could leave, you know, but he's still alive. Of course, you don't allow guns in here, so you might not make it back to SA. If you've ever had the pleasure of paddling the Rio Grande, you know that whenever you're on a lake, on the lower canyons of the Rio Grande, all hell's about to break. You're going to run into a rapid. So it's a pool and draw river. But the state, to my knowledge, has never had to repair those rapids. Think of them as dams. Rio Vista Dam on the San Marcos has been turned into Rio Vista Falls. Gibb and I were instrumental in talking the city of San Marcos into doing that. Dams fail. These 100-year-old dams are failing. But you can still have pools and draws. You can build, turn ugly concrete dams into beautiful rapids, and the fishermen can still have their pools. You wouldn't make them as big as the current dam, but you can make more of them. So what I'd recommend is I know y'all aren't excited about wading into this controversial issue, but y'all are great at task forces. Set up a task force, work with GVRA, let's get all the people together and look at all these different alternatives and see if we can't solve this, make some beautiful, I think, beautiful rapids instead of ugly concrete dams. I think it'd be a win-win situation, but and I hope I make it home. Thanks.
Thank you. Mansell Denton and Cindy Cassidy.
Thank you all. In the interest of time, I want to first express my concern for the way that mountain lions are treated in the state and offer two simple changes that I think could help. Number one, currently it is legal to set up a snare, allow an animal to be trapped, and then have that animal slowly suffer and die without water, without food, and without a trapper checking. I don't believe this is ethical. Like many of you, I'm a hunter. In a few weeks, I'll be starting archery whitetail season, so I understand that at times it's justified to kill for food, for protection, but I don't think any hunter in good conscience can agree that allowing an animal to suffer over a time is justified. I've had conversations with some of the foremost trappers, like Billy Applegate, to understand their perspective, the mammalogist, and it seems to me that we have the resources and we have the technology to institute 36-hour trap check laws on mountain lion trapping. Number two, when I spent time speaking with all the experts, it became abundantly clear nobody has a really good understanding of exactly how many mountain lions are in the state, and that's just a result of poor data right now. So I recommend mandatory harvest reporting so that we have better data. It's simple to ask the trappers and hunters to report better data because we're currently facing added problems with the border wall preventing some of the migration from mountain lions coming into the state. I think it's worthwhile for us to at least get the data so we can manage the resource that belongs to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
My name is Cindy Luongo Cassidy, and I join Manuel in asking you to step up and to make some positive changes for this iconic Texas native, the mountain lion. And you may know that we have two populations of mountain lions in the state of Texas, in West Texas and South Texas. And Texas is the only state that does not protect our mountain lions at all. They're classified as S2, imperiled by Texas Parks and Wildlife, as a species of greatest conservation need. And yet they're a non-game species and have zero protection. They can be hunted, trapped, killed year-round, which is a valid hunting license. So we do ask that you use your authority to require that it be reported when they're killed, and that you limit the number of hours between the times that traps are checked. mountain lions will kill a lot of feral hogs. There was a study done, and that costs the state of Texas billions of dollars every year. Last year, I believe it was $52 billion. There was one study in Texas that did an investigation of 200 mountain lion kill sites that revealed absolutely zero livestock deprivation. The distance of the regular predators means we do have a healthy ecosystem right now, but let's protect them. I've spoken to y'all before on a entirely different topic. My husband and I have helped with making the state parks designated international dark sky parks. So I want to leave you guys with some fun stickers that just drop them off. So the skies aren't the only thing I care about.
Thank you. Next up, we have John Kuntz, Dr. Craig Nazor, and then followed by Evelyn Mertz.
Hello, my name is John Kuntz. I'm a frequent state park visitor and a touring cyclist. I'm here to ask Texas Parks and Wildlife to consider adopting a no-turnaway policy, as has been found in 9 other states. I distributed some more detailed information to you all that has case studies and sample policies from these other states showing how this can be done. A no-turnaway policy is a guarantee of a camping spot, even if it's just a patch of grass by the park headquarters, for people arriving under their own power. That would include cyclists, canoeists, backpackers, and finding that the campground is full. It is not for people who attempt to enter the park, leaving their vehicles outside the park, or for cyclists with vehicular support, and it's not a freebie. People arriving at a full park had intended to pay, and so should pay. And why? Partly it's a safety issue. It can take all day to ride 75 miles, the distance a car can cover in an hour. Weather conditions, mechanical issues, and just plain exhaustion can make arriving at a certain park at a certain time on a certain day very uncertain. Being turned away with nowhere to legally camp can put a cyclist in danger. And that's happened to me several times. There are 16 state parks here in Texas along established cycling routes, including the Southern Tier that goes across the country and the Hill Country Loop. Both of those tours actually pass about half a mile from here. Please consider at least a trial at Pardinalis Falls, Bastrop, Blanco, Lost Maples, and Seminole Canyon because they are along those tours. Benefits, increased revenue. If they're turned away, they don't pay. Thousands of cyclists tour Texas every year and spend up to 40% more in local economies than car drivers covering similar distances. Touring cyclists, backpackers, and canoeists tend to support conservation and sustainability, and so are a good fit for our great state parks. Thank you.
Thank you. Something to think about. Dr. Nazor?
Greetings, Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission. My name is Craig Nazor. I am the vice chair of the Conservation Committee of the Lone Star Chapter of the Sierra Club. I'm here today to talk to you about a true American gem, Balmoray State Park. As you know, Balmoray contains San Solomon Springs, which supplies water to one of the largest artesian spring-fed pools in the world. Being located in a very hot and arid part of Texas, this park has supplied humans with a source of cool, clean water since humans first arrived in North America over 10,000 years ago. It supports much wildlife, including 5 endangered species. It is our belief that this park, particularly San Solomon Springs, is under threat. Your commission is in charge of this resource. Protection of the springs is your responsibility. There are originally 5 springs in the group of springs that are found in this area. Some of these springs now only run intermittently. This year, the flows into San Solomon Springs are down by a third. We find this alarming. Recently, there has been a large amount of fossil fuel development to the north of San Solomon Springs. This development involves fracking, which uses large amounts of water drawn from the aquifer. This water is combined with chemicals whose names the public is not allowed to know, which is then reinjected into the ground. The wastewater from this process is also reinjected into the ground. There are an increasing number of earthquakes in the area since fracking has begun. Air pollution levels are also rising in the area. At the very least, Texas Parks and Wildlife should come up with more accurate methods to monitor spring flows. Monitoring air pollution at the park is also something that should commence. But we would also like to see more engagement from Texas Parks and Wildlife to monitor the fossil fuel extraction process that now endanger this park. The pollution of groundwater is difficult, if not impossible, to reverse. Once water quality is compromised, the park will be seriously damaged. Are the profits of the fossil fuel industry worth this risk? This industry, ironically, is an industry that is now damaging the climate of the entire planet. We believe Texas could do better. Thank you for your attention to this important matter.
Thank you. Sorry, go ahead, Evelyn.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Evelyn Mers. I'm the conservation chair of the Lone Star chapter of the Sierra Club. I'd like to address two concerns today. First, we are concerned about the long-term sustainability of Balmoray State Park, particularly related to the demands upon San Solomon Springs. As we all know, aquifers have had declines across Texas. Increased population, agricultural demands have been traditional stressors. But aquifers located in areas experiencing heavy fracking activity have added another element. Reeves County, in which Balmoray is located, is experiencing a fracking boom. In the last 2 years, the monitoring of San Solomon Springs has changed from quarterly to continuous. I understand that the monitoring of the outflow at Balmoray is being done, but the measurements could be flawed because of a gate problem. The long-term San Solomon flow data does show some decline, but with fracking demand, it will be declined even more. There will be a downward trajectory. Balmoray State Park at 47 acres is the best-known piece of earth in Reeves County. It will be the poster child for aquifer sustainability in West Texas. There's an important step that Parks and Wildlife could take in addition to its current monitoring and studies. That is to advocate for the formation of a groundwater conservation district in Reeves County. As the most visible stakeholder in the county and the guardian of Balmoray State Park, that would be one of the most useful actions that could be taken. The second item is the update of the management plan for the East Texas Black Bear. The previous plan expired in 2015. Since before 2015, Texas Parks and Wildlife has been requested repeatedly about the status of the plan update. We have always been told that it is in progress, but we never get a definite answer. The Texas Parks and Wildlife website on Black Bear still has a note that a group was formed in 2002 to develop a plan. But there is no information on the website after that. Even the website needs updating. But the most important thing is I believe that the people who care about the East Texas Black Bear and its management plan do deserve a straight answer about when that management plan is going to be finished. Thank you all.
Thank you, Evelyn. That was... You ever have a comment, jump in, so...
Evelyn, I'm happy to talk to you about that later. Yeah. Thank you.
Shane Bonat and Kirby Brown.
Good afternoon. My name's Shane Bonat. I'm from Lake Jackson, Texas. I'm here representing the Coastal Conservation Association of Texas. First of all, Mr. Morin, congratulations on your being named chairman. Glad to see you in that seat. And Commissioner Hildebrand, Abel Patton, glad to see you here. Congratulations on your appointments, and Commissioner Gallo, your reappointment. Congratulations to you. I want to thank this department and Coastal Fisheries specifically for the leadership they've shown in the second year of the exempted fishing permit for red snapper in federal waters. We experienced a great red snapper season this past summer. The season was projected to go 97 days. Parks and Wildlife, through their krill surveys and monitoring the catch that anglers were bringing in, decided to close the season earlier than that projected 97 days. And it just showed how flexible the department is and their ability to manage red snapper in state and federal waters. So we appreciate that, and we're looking forward to true state management of red snapper and moving forward in that fishery. So great job to this department. And I want to thank Lance Robinson and Robin Rikers and Coastal Fisheries for their leadership at the Gulf Council. That's the regional body that makes decisions for fisheries in federal waters like red snapper and gray snapper, amberjack, cobia. That is not a fun process. I can't imagine they look forward to having to go to Gulf Council meetings, but they show up and they speak up, and they speak up for Texas, and we appreciate their efforts. And then finally, to our game wardens, busting their tails down south on the border, pulling up gill nets, battling the launch a fleet that we see coming out of Mexico that are illegally taking sharks and snapper from state waters. It's we thank those guys for what they do. I can't imagine. That's got to be a difficult job, and it seems to never end, so we appreciate them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shane.
Mr. Chairman, congratulations on your appointment. Commissioners, especially new commissioners, thank you for your service. My name is Kirby Brown, conservation outreach biologist with Ducks Unlimited. Ducks Unlimited is the largest wetlands organization in the world and are more than 1 million members nationally, and including 50,000 people from Texas. We want to thank the Parks and Wildlife Commission and staff for our long-term partnership that we've had on wetlands conservation in Texas. And the partnership is one of the strongest anywhere in the United States. The TPW Commission has long recognized that waterfowl are a shared resource, that wetland habitat conservation has to take place not only here in Texas, but also in the breeding grounds in Canada, where most of our waterfowl are produced, and in Mexico, where many of our waterfowl overwinter. The Texas annual contribution to the state grant program, a specific program, sends state migratory game bird stamp money funds specifically for wetlands conservation in Canada. Long-term banding data show that 48% of our ducks that we harvest in Texas come from Saskatchewan and Alberta, and most of your projects are there. Last year, Texas was the first and only state to provide funding for a wetlands project in Mexico with DU Mexico, very critical wetlands project. Our Texas migratory stamp dollars are leveraged by Ducks Unlimited and our Canadian partners when they go to Canada four times at a minimum, and some years five and six, sometimes seven times, just because of the dollar and the exchange rate, multiplying your wetland habitat impact up there in that region. And here in Texas, much more, such as our partnership on Texas Prairie Wetlands Program, now providing over 90,000 acres of wetland habitat on private lands with those voluntary agreements with landowners, assisting our WMA, state parks, and others with wetland project design, engineering, construction, not just creating wetland habitat, but opportunities for hunting and bird watching and outdoor education. Working with partners like TPW, Ducks Unlimited has now conserved, and drum roll please, over 15 million acres of habitat in North America. Pretty remarkable feat for all of us as partners. And we want to thank you for your part in the impressive accomplishment. And on behalf of DU and all waterfowlers, thank you for your unwavering support for all we do for Texas Wetland. Just to end up, a special thanks to Carter Smith, Clayton Wolf, the Migratory Bird staff with Sean Oldenberger, Kevin Cry, and Jeff Roush, the WMA staff, Robin Rikers, Coastal Fisheries staff, and Ted Hollingsworth. And when we look at it, right now, we are at the best times for duck hunting any time in the last 70 years of waterfowl surveys, so thank you very much. Appreciate you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Leona Hazelwood and Jessica Gordon.
Hello, thanks for letting us come here to speak today. My name's Leona Hazelwood. I'm from San Marcos, Texas. And I have several issues that I would like to address here today. The first thing is I would like for Texas Parks and Wildlife to impose a moratorium on the use of glyphosate being sprayed directly into our public waterways and around our public waterways. Being a likely known carcinogen when applied directly to humans, it also is known and documented to break down our ecosystems. And what this does is it allows toxic cyanobacteria to bloom in our lakes and rivers. We've seen this on the news lately in Guadalupe River and Lake Austin. You know, it's toxic to our pets. It's also toxic to humans, which has also been documented since 2009 by the Department of the Interior. Cyanobacteria releases a modified amino acid that causes neurological degradation of humans and can be implicated in diseases like ALS. This is a serious concern because this is a lot of our public's drinking water supply. And I'm pretty sure nobody's testing for this presence of this chemical in our water supply while we're drinking it. That's the first thing. And then along those same lines, I would like for Texas Parks and Wildlife to consider the use of industrial hemp to allow for mitigation of the nutrient excess in urban areas and around public golf courses, as well as possibly around industrial agriculture. I would also like full transparency about the issues going on with Balmoray, including the water supply, the fresh water supply there. Where is it going? What's causing the structural damage at Balmoray? And where have the dark skies gone in Balmoray? I would also like for Texas Parks and Wildlife to uphold our current Texas laws to protect our endangered species, despite what our national laws may become. And lastly, I would hope that we can establish an external nonpartisan review board to examine the ethics of our commissioners here, just because about 50% of y'all are associated with major oil and gas auto industry, and so I think there could be direct conflicts of interest, and I would like to help ensure the public that all of our resources as public citizens are being utilized to maintain the mission of Texas Parks and Wildlife, to protect our wildlife, and not take advantage of our resources, of all of our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Jessica Gordon.
Hello, I'm Jessica Gordon, chair of the Texas Biological Association and editor of the Texas Caber magazine. I would like to begin by thanking you for protecting access to an amazing network of public lands across the state. These lands are invaluable for connecting people to nature, improving quality of life, and inspiring the next generation of environmental stewards. TSA has worked with Texas Parks and Wildlife for over 30 years, leading volunteer-run projects to document and map caves and karst features on Texas Parks and Wildlife lands. For example, Colorado Bend State Park project started in 1987. One of TSA's project leaders for Government Canyon State Natural Area recently came out with a book publication on the caves of Government Canyon. This property alone has over 60 documented caves and many yet to be discovered. And this area is very environmentally sensitive and surrounded by rapid development and impervious cover. A cave we mapped this past January made the issue of our Texas Caber magazine, and this area was on the part of the land that was more recently acquired to protect water quality in the Edwards Aquifer. These caves and karst landscapes are full of caves, home to endangered and endemic species, and critical for protecting water quality. I look forward to continuing to work with Texas Parks and Wildlife and hope you can find ways to acquire and protect more of these fragile landscapes for our future. Thank you.
Thank you. Does Mr. Navarro care to speak?
Yeah. Thank you very much for the chance to speak. I just wanted to add to the previous comment about the use of glyphosate, and I wanted to ask if the commission could research the negative impacts of glyphosate and other chemicals in Roundup herbicides and remove their use from all Texas Parks and Wildlife habitat restoration projects. From what I understand, I may not have full information, but I do understand that some of the excellent restoration projects are being carried out with private landowners initially used glyphosate as a weed, or Roundup as a weed killer, to kill out all invasive species, and then over several years start replanting native species. I hope that the department can find another way to do restoration projects without using glyphosate or these other pesticides, because they end up in our aquifers, affecting wildlife that depends on the aquifer, plus future generations of the children who will be drinking this stuff for generations to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would care to speak that I've missed? Well, if not, those that are still here, I'd like to thank you for making the effort to come here and give us your opinions and thoughts. It's important. With that, I'm going to declare that the commission has completed its business, and I declare us adjourned at 3:06, and thank all of you very much. Thank you.